House State Administration will come to order. Will the secretary please take the roll?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vice Chair Grief.
Here.
Vice Chair Weatherwax.
Here.
Representative Bertolio.
Here.
Representative Clee.
Here.
Representative Bishop.
Excuse.
Representative Custer.
Here.
Representative Dooling.
Here.
Representative Frazier.
Excused.
Representative Heyman.
Here.
Representative Hill.
Here.
Representative Carjala.
Here.
Representative Cordham.
Here.
Representative Putnam.
Here.
Representative Rexton.
Here.
Representative Running Wolf.
Excuse.
Representative Smith.
Here.
Representative Walsh.
Here.
Representative Whitman.
Here.
Chair McKamey.
Here.
That is all. Thank you.
Just a few announcements before we begin. Please silence your cell phones, and if you must take a call, please step outside the committee room. And if you wish to give testimony, please sign in at the door, providing your name and affiliation, if any. Please note the information in your testimony is a public record, and the following bills have been scheduled for hearing today. Senate Bill 113, Senate Bill 227, Senate Bill... Where's my 225? Oh, excuse me. Senate Bill 225, Senate Bill 227, Senate Bill 224, and Senate Bill 226. And I see the sponsor of all these bills is in the room. And we welcome to the podium Senator Steve Fitzpatrick. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nice to be here. I guess I'll open on Senate Bill 113. For the record, Steve Fitzpatrick from Senate District 10 in Great Falls.
Opening on House Bill 113. Sorry.
No, that's fine. All right. So the first bill I have for you is a bill which revises laws pertaining to legislative referenda. And let me give you a little background about this bill. I think it was either in the 15 session or the 13 session, I can't remember which one, the legislature passed a legislative referenda to go to judicial districts, and you guys had a similar bill this session, but there was a referenda to do that, and it got challenged in court, and the Supreme Court ruled that the referenda was illegal because in the title of the referenda, it had more than 100 words when you counted in the statute sections that were being amended. So you know how we have the titles of our bills, and at the end you'll have all the code sections that are being amended or repealed. The Supreme Court said that those numbers were words, and because there were more than 100 words, the referenda got thrown off the ballot. So what this bill does is it clarifies that when we pass a legislative referenda, that the numbers in the title don't count as words. So a simple bill, I think of it this way, numbers are not words. So with that, that's the opening. I hope you'll pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator, are there any proponents for Senate Bill 113? Seeing none on site, are there any online?
Madam Chair, there are no
Thank you.
Proponents or opponents.
Okay, thank you. Calling now for opponents on site. Seeing none, we will go to informational witnesses. Are there any informational witnesses?
Madam Chair, Regina Plattenberg signed up, but she is not called in as an informational person.
Okay, thank you. In that case, seeing none, we will move to questions from the committee. Questions from the committee? Are there any questions from the committee? Seeing none, Senator, would you like to close on your bill?
Thank you for a perfect hearing. I appreciate support on that bill. Thank you.
This closes the hearing on Senate Bill 113. Seeing the sponsor is in the room for Senate Bill 225, we will open the hearing on Senate Bill 225. Welcome, Senator Fitzpatrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Steve Fitzpatrick, Senate District 10 from Great Falls. The next bill I have for you is a bill to revise the Administrative Rule, Administrative Procedure Act. And what this bill does is it prevents the executive branch from taking a bill which failed in a previous legislative session and turning that into an administrative rule. And just to give you a little background, when we're talking about administrative rules, what has happened is that the legislative branch over time has granted the executive branch enormous power to write rules, administrative rules, and there's a fairly simple process for them to do that. They draft a rule, post it, it goes out for a comment, and then it basically becomes a law unless there's, you know, a legal challenge to it. And those rules have the same force and effect as a law we pass here, but it doesn't go through the, you know, the legislative process. And it's almost impossible after a rule has been made to repeal it or get rid of it. So what has happened in the last few cycles is that the executive branch or other people have brought in bills, and they've brought them to the legislature, and they have failed. And then they came back in the administrative rule process and took that same bill and tried to turn it into a rule, and it has happened multiple times in the last few years. And a couple examples are, there was the vaping bill. There was a vaping bill that failed in the legislature. They tried to turn that into a rule. Senate Bill 71, that was a bill that got vetoed, and they attempted to turn that one into a rule. It's my understanding that's been happening in the workers' compensation field. So we have all these types of examples where the executive branch is basically trying to override the will of the legislative branch and pass into law, you know, fundamentally law without going through the lawmaking process and basically ignoring the will of the legislature. So I think this is a really an important bill for, you know, asserting our rights as legislators to have a voice in the lawmaking process and to make sure that our decisions are respected by the executive branch. So with that, I would hope you will support this bill.
Thank you, Senator. Are there any proponents for Senate Bill 225? Welcome.
Good morning, Chair McCamey and members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Lasloffy, L-A-S-Z-L-O-F-F-Y. We rise with the Montana Family Foundation. We rise today in support of Senate Bill 225. We want to thank Senator Fitzpatrick for bringing it forward. I'm going to go into a little more detail on the next bill, Senate Bill 227. But we support this bill as well. And for this reason, we believe that we've been involved in many challenges to administrative rules over the past 20 years. And it seems that with every session, the agencies are promulgating more and more rules. And we understand why the administrative rule process happens. They flesh out the policy that you set in the legislature. But now they've gone beyond that. Now they're actually creating law. They're actually acting as the legislative branch. And the main problem we have with that is the procedure. So here in the legislature, if a bill is brought to you, that bill needs a positive action at every single step of the way. You need a positive vote to move that bill forward. Bills die on a tie vote in the legislature. When you look at the administrative rulemaking process, that rule, once promulgated, is on a glide path to passage. The only way to stop it is with a positive vote to stop it. So it takes the legislative process and completely flips it. The challenge is that with the administrative rulemaking process, the only way along the way to stop it is through the Oversight Committee, the Legislative Interim Committee that has control over that agency. They can vote to stop that at one of their hearings. The problem is those committees are tied. And so if it's something innocuous, they may or may not vote to stop it. But if it's something highly controversial, and especially in the case of the bills that that Senator Fitzpatrick is talking about that came out of a legislative session and there was contention there, that bill, once promulgated, is probably going to pass because there's going to be a tie vote in the legislative interim committee. And so we think that this is a that this is an important bill for just that reason. For the on this particular bill, I'm coming in and I'm addressing process. I'll address some greater issues in the next bill, but we think that Senate Bill 225 is a good idea. We think it's a good start, and we hope that you give it due consideration and a due pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Laszlofy. Are there any further proponents for Senate Bill 225? Seeing none on site, are there any online? Ms. Street.
Madam Chair, there are no proponents, opponents, or informational for Senate Bill 225.
Thank you very much, Ms. Street. Call for informational witnesses then on site. Are there any informational witnesses? Okay, calling for informational witnesses on site. Is this an opponent? Okay. Backing up, we will call for opponents for Senate Bill 225. Welcome, Madam Lieutenant Governor.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I am Kristen Juris, Lieutenant Governor of the State of Montana, appearing on behalf of Governor Gianforte in opposition to SB 225. I do have a handout. May I hand it?
Yes, absolutely.
So first of all, let me say that the concept behind this legislation, we understand. There should never be an agency that promulgates a rule outside of the legislation that you, this body, has adopted. However, once you do adopt legislation under our Constitution, the separation of powers, the implementation of that legislation is the responsibility of the executive branch. And there is current law that respects and enforces this separation of powers. The Montana Administrative Procedure Act specifically states that every proposed and adopted rule must cite to the specific grant of rulemaking authority under which that rule is promulgated. It also says that for a rule to be effective, it must be within the scope of the authority conferred. It must be consistent and not in conflict with the statute, and it must be reasonably necessary to effectuate the purpose of the statute. As an additional check on an agency's rulemaking authority, this body, as Mr. Laszlofy noted, has the authority to review administrative rules. Each interim committee has a duty to review every proposed administrative rule within its jurisdiction. The committee may object to any proposed rule. The committee may recommend amendments to any proposed rule. And I don't know in the examples that were given how the committee failed in its oversight responsibility. That's a failure of the legislature. I mean, they could have stopped these had they not been authorized or consistent with the statute, and they failed to do so. And then finally, if the legislature is not in session, the committees may poll all members of the legislature by mail to determine whether a proposed rule is consistent with the legislation's intent. As a final check on an agency's rulemaking authority, the legislature has the authority under current law to, by bill, direct the adoption, amendment, or repeal of any administrative rule. So that would have been another check in these examples that was not exercised. Or by joint resolution, request or advise the adoption, amendment, or repeal of any administrative rule. SB 225 prohibits an agency from adopting a rule that relates to a subject matter substantially similar to legislation that failed to pass. Bills fail to pass for any number of reasons, as you all well know. For example, just this session, numerous bills have been introduced that limit the government's authority during periods of emergency. Good bills, good ideas. But many of these bills have actually already been tabled because the sponsors of those bills are working with the sponsors of similar bills to present a comprehensive bill. And the statute really leaves in question, what does failed mean? So some of these bills are tabled because their provisions are going forward in other bills. So now, does the agency is not able to promulgate rules under the tabled bills, which are exactly the same as elements of the bill that was passed? Do you see the confusion that that is going to cause to agencies? And do you see the burden that you would be imposing on agencies to not only understand every bill that is implemented, but to keep a copy of the hundreds of bills that were introduced, not enacted, and go back with every rule and look at the substance of those bills? And again, what if the substance of those bills conflicts with, because another bill actually contained one of those provisions and was passed? So this is going to be a very difficult bill for the agencies to implement. It is unnecessary in view of the numerous provisions in the statute, which I've cited to, that already give checks on an agency's authority. And for these reasons, the governor's office requests a do not pass on SB 225. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Lieutenant Governor. Are there further opponents to Senate Bill 225? Seeing none on site and there are none online, we will now move to informational witnesses. Are there any informational witnesses on site? And there are no informational witnesses online, so we will move to questions from the committee. Questions from the committee? Representative Putnam and then Representative Grief.
Madam Chair, question for the sponsor.
Senator Fitzpatrick, please.
Madam Chair, Senator, what was your intention as far as, or more of a clearer definition of failed to pass? Would it be drafted, introduced, made it to committee, failed on the floor, failed in the Senate? I guess at what point would it a bill be considered failed?
I think it
Chair, please.
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Putnam. It would be any step in the process where it was presented to the legislature, either in a committee, all the way up through a veto. So that would be the definition. It obviously wouldn't be something that was in drafting and never got introduced that didn't fail to pass the legislature. So it would have to be something that was introduced and then voted on.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Vice Chair Grief.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the sponsor.
Senator Fitzpatrick, please.
Senator Fitzpatrick, could you please respond to the Lieutenant Governor's statement?
Sure, I'd like to, Madam Chair, Representative Grief, I'd like to go through a couple of the points. First of all, I think when we step back and think about rulemaking, if the agency already had the power to implement the rule, I don't think that they would need to come to the legislature and then ask for the bill to be presented and then voted upon. So I think if that authority is already there, then I don't understand why we would then bring in a bill and then need to go through the process of then trying to implement it as a bill. But in terms of the power of the legislature, I disagree with the assertion that the legislature has a lot of power in the rulemaking process. I mean, let's start with the first one that was mentioned, a bill. We could have passed all the bills we wanted in the last cycle and to try and overturn a rule, and they would all have been vetoed by Governor Bullock. So that's not an effective check on the executive branch's ability to write rules. The process of blocking a rule in an interim committee, that's also very hard because, you know, our interim committees are split 50-50 partisan. So you have to get somebody to break ranks and vote for the other side. I mean, I think I've seen lots of examples where bills that have or rules that probably the majority of the legislature didn't like went into law because of the nature of our interim committees. The pull of the legislature, you know, we've done that, and that, you know, it's just an opinion of the legislature. It has no effect on stopping a rule. The joint resolution, again, you know, it does nothing. I mean, it doesn't change the rule. I mean, we're just asking for changes. The agency is in its power to say no. And then finally, the idea that just because they have to cite authority in the rulemaking process doesn't mean they go outside the bounds of the power of the statute. I mean, that's what happened with, if I understand correctly, the process with the Senate Bill 71 rule. That went through the rulemaking process, and then there was a lawsuit, and a court had to throw it out. So, I mean, that's the problem here, is that the rulemaking authority is so weak. I mean, we can do so few things to stop rules in the process that we can't, you know, the checks and balances are so weighed in favor of the executive branch, it's not even funny. So I guess that's the best response I can give.
Thank you, Senator.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Karjala.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for the bill sponsor, please.
Senator Fitzpatrick, please.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, my question is regarding interim bills or interim study bills. So I think it was the 2017 interim session study bill passed to study allowing pharmacist practitioners, pharmacists who have medical doctorates, to prescribe out of network for the purpose of crisis stabilization. And that could have been anything from a psychiatric circumstance to asthma to a heart condition, diabetes, ketoacidosis. So this bill ended up going to an interim committee where the department came in and said, we like this bill so much, we're going to just put it into administrative rules. So the committee agreed. I think that bill probably would have gone on to pass. But how would you interpret that, were this bill to pass? Would it go to the fact that it didn't pass during a legislative session to codify the permission for the pharmacist practitioners, or would it go back to the study bill passing to allow us to study that? I just need a little bit of clarification.
Madam Chair, Representative Karjala, I think as long as you start the rulemaking process before the bill has failed, then I don't think that there's a problem with that. If that's the answer to your question, as long as it started ahead of time, it's the notion that it failed, and the words are the previous legislative session. So, if you started the rulemaking process after the legislative session ended, then you're going to have to wait until the next legislature passes before you can implement that same rule. If that answers your question.
Madam Chair, just a clarification.
A follow-up, Representative Karjala.
Thank you. Madam Chair, sorry, I probably haven't had enough coffee. So you're saying that if this bill were passed, that administrative rule would not have been able to be adopted?
Madam Chair, Representative Karjala, as long as the rulemaking didn't start after the, if the rulemaking started after the legislative session ended, that's the way it's written. It's legislation which failed to pass in the previous legislative session. And I think the key words here are substantially similar. So, I mean, it's not like we're picking bits and pieces out of bills and saying it's got to be substantially similar to the rule has to be substantially similar to a failed bill. Not we had one line in this bill and four lines in another bill. It's got to be almost mimicking the bill. So that's the idea here. And if we want to tighten that down, I'm certainly happy to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Representative Heyman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the sponsor.
Senator Fitzpatrick, please.
Madam Chair, Senator Fitzpatrick, who is going to provide the oversight review of this? How would that process work within government?
Madam Chair, Representative Heyman, I think the way this is really going to work is if there's a lawsuit challenging the implementation of the rule. I mean, the rules are going to go through, and if somebody objects, then, I mean, ultimately this is where you end up with this, would be in a challenge to the validity of the rule.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Fitzpatrick.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Rexton.
Madam Chair, for the sponsor.
Senator Fitzpatrick, please.
Madam Chair, Senator Fitzpatrick, you've labeled, I guess, is it Senate Bill 71 as one of the examples of where failed legislation was picked up by the governor's office. Can you clarify what happened in that case? And can you give us any other examples of what you're attempting to change by this legislation?
Madam Chair, Representative Rexine, so it's my understanding that Senate Bill 71 was actually one brought by the auditor's office, and it came in through the legislative process last year. It got all the way down to the governor's office, got vetoed. Then the auditor's office, as I understand it, turned around and tried to implement that whole bill into a rule. And it went through the rulemaking process, and as I understand it, there was a lawsuit, and the district court here in Helena killed the rule. Now, the governor's office, so this was Governor Bullock's office, as I understand it, did it with the vaping rule. And I don't have firsthand knowledge, but I have been told that this has been tried also in the workers' comp field as well, where there's been failed bills, which they've tried to turn into administrative rules. I can't give you any examples. This is just what somebody told me. So I know of the vaping one. The vaping one is the big one, and that's what motivated me. But then as I've heard other stories as we've gone along.
Follow-up, Representative Rexton.
Madam Chair, I'd like to ask our Madam Lieutenant Governor a question related to this.
Okay. Madam Lieutenant Governor, please.
Madam Chair and Madam Lieutenant Governor, can you, you know, do you have knowledge of this particular case and what might be different with the new administration in charge now at the governor's level?
Madam Chair, Representative, I am familiar with these examples. I haven't studied them intensively. And that's why I understand the concept behind this. There should never be an agency that adopts a rule that it hasn't been granted the authority to. I think everyone in the room agrees on that. But I believe that the statutes are already in place that could have prevented that from happening, and they weren't exercised. Part of it may be the problem with the interim committee. But again, a third branch of the government, the judiciary, ultimately is the one who is the final check on administrative rules that exceed the statutory authority granted to them. And that is the method of ultimately correcting these problems under the current law, and as Senator Fitzpatrick mentioned in response to the other representative's question, really, how is this going to be implemented any differently? It won't be. It's ultimately the courts who are going to say, and they already have that authority to say, these particular rules go beyond the statutory authority granted them. It does happen. I will say, and I think we all agree, it's fairly rare that it happens. Sometimes there's different interpretations of rules. Sometimes it's more blatant, as these examples. But there is a system in place that corrects that. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Representative Walsh.
Madam Chair, a question for the bill sponsor.
Senator Fitzpatrick.
Madam Chair, Senator Fitzpatrick, would this bill apply to all legislation passed or just agency-requested legislation?
Madam Chair, Representative Walsh, it's any legislation. So if somebody brought a bill and it failed and you try to bring a rule that's substantially similar to it, it's done. And the reason there's more to it besides just litigation, it obviously would be further grounds to say in your comments, if you're, you know, somebody's commenting on the rule, say, look, you tried this in the previous legislature, it's failed. This is just an additional step to give a little bit more ammo to stop some of these administrative rules. So it's not just a lawsuit. It's, you know, the commenters can say, yeah, you know, you tried this and it's done, so you don't have any grounds to do it.
Follow up, Representative Walsh.
Madam Chair, Senator Fitzpatrick, so the bill is tabled. You're saying that it's failed, but really hasn't had a negative vote. So do we need to define failed here a little bit, or am I missing that in the bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Walsh, if we want to put in a definition of what it means to be failed, you know, tabled in a committee, I'm happy to come up with an amendment for you to clarify that down. I mean, I'm happy to, you know, I think it's been clear it's come into the committee, into the legislative process, and failed during one of the steps. I mean, if we want to say voted in committee and or vetoed by the governor, whatever you want, I'm happy to add that in there if you'd like.
Well,
follow up, Representative Walsh.
Madam Chair. Senator Fitzpatrick, well, then if it's vetoed by the governor, then the legislation didn't fail. It by the legislature, it failed by the governor. So that's just what I'm just trying to understand. How do we tie this all down and so that there is some consistency maybe across and lack confusion.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Walsh, I think vetoed, it's failed the legislative process. So it's failed to go through the legislative process. I think that's the idea here. It's failed to pass through the legislative process, and a veto is certainly going to count in that. I mean, I realize it's a different branch of government, but he is part of the legislative process.
Thank you.
Any further questions from the committee? If not, I have one for the sponsor, please.
Get my exercise here.
You really are. If you didn't get a workout before, you're going to get a workout now.
That's right.
Okay. Senator Fitzpatrick, with the... Actually, I have two questions
sure.
for you. Is it not correct that each proposal, each bill, whether it be resolution proposal or whatever, has to have a positive action as was stated by a previous... witness today?
So, Madam Chair, that's correct. In order to pass a bill through the legislature, there has to be a positive action every step of the way. And that's what's different about rulemaking. It's the opposite for the legislative branch.
Right.
We can't stop anything unless we have a positive action. So it's like you said, it's been flipped on its head, and that's really a conundrum for the legislative branch, is that, I mean, we're so powerless when it comes to rules. I mean, it's just utterly powerless. I mean, once a rule, it's there, it's pretty much going to go into law unless you can block it in committee, and that's so rare. I mean, I've blocked a couple before. You got to remember, the block is only temporary too. It's either 6 months, and you can get it up to 12, and then you got to revote it again. So we did that in water policy one time. We blocked it for 6 months, and then we had to come back and block it again. So it's very hard to stop these rules.
Senator Fitzpatrick, I have a couple more questions. So if you will please indulge me. With the interim committees, are there not ways to affect the breaking of a tie? I know that there are. Are you aware of them?
So, Madam Chair, the only way I know to break a tie is you get there's a bill coming which allows for the breaking of ties, but right now there is no breaking of the ties. If you lock up at 5-5 or 4-4 in the committee, then you can't stop the rule.
If I may, with all due respect, just to give information at this time, that the way that we proposed to give to break a tie in the interim committee was by two ways. By having a quorum of both the Senate, requiring a quorum of the Senate, a quorum of the House members on the interim committee in order to have the vote, and it had to be present in voting. No proxies were allowed. And so that that was, in effect, the way to not keep from having good legislation or good rulemaking or whatever go through the interim committee. It was to require the interim committee to do its work and to pay attention to the work and not be derelict and not taking the interim committee seriously. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the interim committee is, for want of a better word, not considered as a real part of the legislature. And by shoring it up and requiring that, it actually fortified the interim committee. That's just by way of information. I thought it would be important for you to know in case you ever encounter it again. It might make some sense to know that. Are there any further questions from the committee? If not, Senator, would you like to close on your bill?
Thank you. Good questions. I hope you'll pass the bill. I think this is a good bill. I think it does rein in some of the rulemaking process here at the legislative branch or through the executive branch. Thank you.
Thank you. This closes the hearing on Senate Bill 225. Now we'll open the hearing on Senate Bill 227. Senator Fitzpatrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Steve Fitzpatrick, Senate District 10. Next bill I have for you is a rather straightforward bill. This allows a administrative rule to be repealed with a resolution. And the reason for that is the rules have been implemented. We've seen it multiple times. And in order to get rid of the rule, you got to pass a bill. And obviously, if you have a person of a government, the governor, who just implemented the rule, he's probably not going to be signing a bill that repeals the rule, and probably in very small circumstances. So again, another bill which allows us to reassert our power under the as part of the legislative branch. This is only allows for repeal by resolution in the 2 year period after the rule has been adopted. So it's a check on the executive branch for sure. So I'd ask for you to support this bill.
Thank you. Are there proponents for Senate Bill 227 in the room, please? Welcome, Mr. Laslaffy.
Good morning once again, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Laslaffy, Laslofffy, with the Montana Family Foundation. We rise in support of Senate Bill 227. Once again, we want to thank Senator Fitzpatrick for bringing it forward. So this is really the bill that gets to the crux of the issue that we've been facing for years as a policy body here in the state of Montana. And it's also one that I find more important to me personally because I used to serve in your seats. I used to be a legislator, and I feel like the legislature needs to jealously guard the power that the legislature has been given. And so, as I said earlier, over the years, we've been involved in several of these, not several, many of these administrative rule questions. And so what I'd like to do this morning is just take you through the timeline of one of the big ones, and it'll help you maybe to understand a little bit better how the process unfolds. I hate to be on the opposition opposing side of a bill against my good friend, the lieutenant governor, and it's also kind of intimidating to go toe-to-toe with somebody that used to be a professor at the law school. But that said, this is our experience. So the bill that I'd like to talk about is Senate Bill 410. It was a 2015 bill, was carried by Senator Lou Jones. And what that did was it established a program in the state of Montana called a tax credit scholarship program. So it would allow corporations or individuals to donate to scholarship granting organizations that in turn would give those scholarships to kids to go to different schools. That bill passed and was allowed to become law without the governor's signature. And then we moved into the rulemaking process, and immediately the Department of Revenue, which was in charge of making the rule, said that this program could be used by any child in the state except by a child desiring to go to a private religious school. That's patently viewpoint discrimination right off the bat. That was our opinion. And when they did this, and that excluded like 90% of the kids in the state from participating in the program that the legislature had just passed. So quickly, the legislature joined in. As we heard, as part of the process, a poll of the legislature was taken. Does the legislature believe that the intent of this law was to allow kids that want to go to private religious schools to participate in the program? Poll came back overwhelmingly. Same votes as were taken to pass the bill initially. Yes, that was the intent of the legislature. So that was established. Then, so the Department of Revenue at that point refused to rescind this rule. And so the Attorney General sent a letter to the head of the Department of Revenue, said, what you are doing is patently indefensible, and if you get sued, we're not going to defend you.
And we knew that they were going to get sued because we already had the legal team lined up ready to do it. Once again, the department ignored the directive, this time from the Department of Justice. And so the next step was to go to the interim committee and ask the interim committee if they would step in and nullify the rule that was being promulgated. Well, we had the problem of the of a tie in an interim committee, and so that failed as well. And so then at that point, lawsuits were filed. Two hearings in district court, one at the Montana Supreme Court, and ultimately the case arrived at the on the doorstep of the United States Supreme Court, and we won what has become a landmark decision in the case of Espinosa versus Montana Department of Revenue, and in so doing, overturned unconstitutional religiously discriminatory language in 38 state constitutions. So in one way, I'm very happy that the administrative rule was promulgated because it allowed us to get to a big constitutional question. That said, this is a classic example of an agency exerting its authority, we believe, in two areas that it should not have been allowed to do. So not only was an executive branch agency acting as a legislative branch entity in promulgating this rule, it determined on its own in reading the new law that the language in there was unconstitutional. And so for that reason, that stated reason, they decided to promulgate this rule. So not only were they acting as a legislative branch entity, they were acting as the judiciary. They were judging constitutionality. They don't get to do that. But that has become the problem. So I think what this gets to is the fact that we have a conflict between policy and practice. We have the process that we're supposed to go through, and there's supposed to be, that process is supposed to be a check on the agency. But in practice, it's not. In practice, the agency, once they promulgate the rule, is going to pass this rule, especially if it's something that's controversial along partisan lines. So that's important to remember. The other thing that's important to remember is that when we went through this process with a different rule, we were told by agents, by the attorneys for the Department of Justice, the legislative legal attorney downstairs, and the attorney for the department, for the Secretary of State, told by all three of them that in the 1980s, the legislature had ceded far too much rulemaking authority to the agencies, and the only way to correct this problem was for the legislature to claw some of that authority back. And so in Senate Bill 227, all that Senator Fitzpatrick is asking is that the legislature be able to weigh in a real way on a rule already promulgated and passed and determine whether or not that rule comports with the desired wishes of the legislature, and to be able to do that through resolution. We see that as a fairly simple way to get at this problem, but we really urge the legislature to do something. Administrative rules for years were handled just the way the legislature had intended them to be, and in the last few years, maybe 10 years, the agencies have gotten fairly aggressive and are now beginning to move on major policy areas and make law rather than just simply fleshing out bills that the legislature has passed. And so for that reason, we ask that you would pass Senate Bill 227. We appreciate your time, and I'd be glad to stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Laszlofy. Are there further proponents for Senate Bill 227? There are none on site. Are there any online, Ms. Street?
Madam Chair, there are no proponents, opponents, or informational for SB 227.
Thank you very much. Seeing none, are there any informational witnesses? Oh, excuse me. Are there opponents on site?
Good morning again, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Kristen Juras, J-U-R-A-S, Lieutenant Governor of the State of Montana, appearing on behalf of Governor Gianforte in opposition to SB 227. I, again, have a handout, if I would have your permission to.
Absolutely.
Again, usually Senator Fitzpatrick, Mr. Laszlovy, and I generally concur in proposed legislation. And let me be the first to say, the Department of Revenue in the Espinoza case absolutely overstepped its rulemaking authority. And that is a problem. And the question is, how do we address that problem? And let me assure you, with regard to the comment that agencies have become aggressive in recent years about overstepping their authority, that is not going to happen on Governor Gianforte's watch. Elections matter. The executive matters. Article 3, Section 1 of the Montana Constitution, you are all familiar with this fundamental principle in federal government and in state government, provides for a separation of powers between the legislative, executive, and judicial branches. No person charged with the exercise of power belonging to one branch shall exercise any power belonging to the other branch. The legislative power is clearly vested in this body. The executive power is vested in the governor, who shall see that the laws that you adopt are faithfully executed. Unfortunately, that didn't happen in the Espinoza case. Other statutory provisions implementing and filling in some of the details on this constitutional framework, Section 2-15-103 recognizes the constitutional status of the governor as the state's chief executive officer. And it requires the governor to administer the policies of the executive branch, and he has full supervision and approval over the actions of the executive agencies. Governor Bullock could have stopped what happened at the Department of Revenue in Espinoza, and he chose not to. MCA 2-15-201 further prescribes the powers and duties of the governor, saying he shall supervise the conduct of all executive officers. I assure you, Governor Gianforte will not allow agencies to overstep the authority that you have granted them. And as I've already discussed, it is a principle of administrative law that an agency may not make rules unless you've given them that power. However, once you pass legislation, and in your legislation you enable the executive branch to write rules to implement that, you have now transferred the power to implement and execute to the executive branch. And I strongly encourage you as lawmakers, you need to put in as many sidebars and parameters on that authority as you deem to be appropriate. Some authorities are very broad, and the Department of Revenue does have an extremely broad grant of authority. Some are very narrow. As a matter of policy, you should all be thinking about putting sidebars on every grant of a legislative authority. So there is control for you. You do have that ability to do that. And I encourage you to do it. But once you delegate that authority under the separation of powers, it now becomes the executive branch that administers and implements that. And let's take a look at this particular statute. Title 2, Chapter 4, Part 4, does allow the legislature under current law by bill. You can direct the adoption, amendment, or repeal of any administrative rule. You could have done that in Espinoza, but as Senator Fitzpatrick pointed out, bills have to be approved by the governor, and perhaps he would have vetoed that. But the reason they do have to be submitted to the governor as a bill is that respects the separation of powers, because he has ultimate authority over the rulemaking authority of his agencies. That is vested in him in the Constitution. And another opportunity you have is by joint resolution, which of course doesn't have to go to the governor for signature. You have the ability to request or advise the adoption, amendment, or repeal of the rule. And when you do that, by the way, you're setting the stage for litigation that you think what the agency has done is outside of your intent, which can become very important when the court decides these issues, if and when it gets to the court. So as currently written, this statutory framework recognizes and respects the separation of powers. You can only repeal a rule by bill, and that then requires ultimately the approval or a veto by the governor. So you're still recognizing and honoring those executive powers. In my opinion, SB 227 is an unlawful violation of the separation of powers. Because if you can repeal a rule by joint resolution, you've taken away from the executive branch their final authority on administrative rules. And as much as Governor Gianforte and I respect your legislative authority, we request that you respect the executive's authority to have final authority over the administrative rules. And if you're unhappy with what the governor does, well, the people can, elections matter, or, you know, we have an open door. I mean, you all can come and talk to us. Furthermore, I have attached your joint rules. Rule 40-60 addresses what you can do with a joint resolution. And if you would take a look at subparagraph J at the very bottom of that page, a joint resolution may only advise or request the repeal, amendment, or adoption of a rule. It cannot effectuate the repeal of a rule. In my opinion, this bill exceeds your joint rules and the scope of authority that you can enact with a joint resolution. For these reasons, the governor's office requests a do not pass on Senate Bill 227. Thank you.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor Juris. Are there further opponents to Senate Bill 227? Seeing none, are there any informational witnesses for Senate Bill 227? There are none on site nor online, so we will proceed to questions from the committee. Questions from the committee, please. Representative Rexton, excuse me.
Madam Chair, for Madam Lieutenant Governor.
Lieutenant Governor Juris, please.
Madam Chair, Madam Lieutenant Governor, are you saying that if this bill passes, that this could eventually end up in court as being unconstitutional? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Madam Chair, Representative Rexton, yes, I do believe that there could be a constitutional challenge to this under the separation of powers, as well as a challenge that you've exceeded the joint rules in what a joint resolution can accomplish.
Okay.
Further questions from the committee? Further questions from the committee? If not, I have a question. First for the sponsor, please. Thank you, Senator Fitzpatrick, for bringing this piece of legislation to us, and I want to applaud your desire to strengthen the legislative branch, because it has, in my opinion, been somewhat weakened over time, and it's time for us to not reassert, but how would you say, shore up? And how do you see this as not being in conflict with the separation of powers?
Madam Chair, that's a good question, and it's one we actually I debated as I put the bill together. The analysis I took was that the rulemaking authority that we've granted to the executive branch is done through the Administrative Procedures Act. So what we're doing here is we're amending the Administrative Procedures Act. But I really think at the end of the day, since rulemaking is really legislating, it really is legislating, I think we have an arguable case to say we're just stepping in and we're not affecting how the governor is implementing the policy. We're affecting basically his what is functionally a legislative purpose. So, I mean, I guess we could have gone through and found every single section of code and amended that, but I think from the drafting point of view, I think by simply amending the Administrative Procedure Act, I think we did the same thing. I want to point out that this is not a unique thing here. At the federal level, there is a statute called the Congressional Review Act, and Congress has the power to I'm not exactly sure the exact procedure, but they do pass resolutions to repeal rules. And in fact, when President Trump was elected, there were a number of resolutions that went through and repealed rules. So that was the genesis of my idea here for the repealing of the resolutions, or repealing rules with resolutions.
Thank you, Senator Fitzpatrick. You answered my second question. I do have another question. Are there further questions from the committee, though, before I ask my question? Further questions? I have a question for Madam Lieutenant Governor Juris, please.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Thank you, Lieutenant Governor Juris. I really appreciate your input on this, and we value that tremendously, first of all. And let me say that there is one thing that we really want to do, and that is to make strong branches of government all the way through, judicial, legislative, and administrative. The executive branch needs to be able to operate in the executive function. I trust Governor Gianforte to do so and to not overstep his bounds. But I'm not sure that I really trust that in the future. And so with legislation like this, I feel like it is a safeguard. Do you see what I am pointing to with that safeguard? And that while we're not trying to bind, do you really see this as binding the governor's ability to operate as the executive?
Madam Chair, I do believe that this bill is a violation of the separation of powers. I believe that where this body, that both the governor and I highly respect, and we understand that laws come from this body, that it is not the function of the executive branch to create laws. You already have in place several checks, legislative reviews of administrative rules. I recommend that you are more active in implementing those. Secondly, you can put sidebars when you delegate statutory authority. I encourage you to put appropriate sidebars up to direct the agencies as to the parameters of their authority. Having said that, we are always going to have some examples. Exempt wells come to mind, where really it's going to be rulemaking, first of all, has to have some discretion, and you may have some rulemaking that it's a close call, and a court may or may not decide that they've exceeded their statutory authority, and that was one particular rule where a court ultimately found that the Department of Natural Resources had exceeded its authority, and now it's back rewriting the rule. So again, you know, we have the judicial check too, and Espinoza, ultimately, the result was right. Our system did work. Our checks and balances did work. We have the best system in the world. And I do believe that this infringes on the executive powers, especially as the Montana Supreme Court has pretty jealously not only protected your powers, but the executive branch powers, as well as their own.
Thank you, Madam Lieutenant Governor Juris. Are there further questions from the committee? Seeing none, Senator, would you like to close on your bill?
I would. Thank you. I think you can understand the problem we have and what we're trying to do with the bill. And I share the same concern that you do, Madam Chair. I certainly appreciate the change in direction with the governor. I certainly trust that he's going to respect the will of the legislative branch. But, you know, unfortunately, Governor Gene Forte will only be our governor for 8 years. And, you know, things change. We get new leadership in the governor's office, and it might not be the same. I mean, it wasn't the same for the past 16 years. So we have to have some check and a balance. And really, this is really a minor check. I think if you read the bill, it only applies to a 2-year interval too. So after the 2-year interval goes by, you got to change it with a bill after that. So this is a narrow window for us to use resolutions to repeal rules or to set them aside. And the final issue I would say on the constitutionality of it, and this is just my opinion as a lawyer, and I heard it from another lawyer legislator here. There are things here that are obviously unconstitutional, and then there are things that maybe, maybe not. Let's let the courts worry about whether this bill is unconstitutional. So with that, I'd ask you to pass it through. And I think this is a good one for really asserting our authority. I think Mr. Lazoff, he gave some tremendous examples. There are other ones. The administrative rule process needs to change. And this is probably the best way for us to do it with this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Fitzpatrick. This closes the hearing on Senate Bill 227. We'll now open the hearing on Senate Bill 224. Senator Fitzpatrick, it's good to see you in the room again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Steve, for the record, Steve Fitzpatrick, Senate District 10. The next bill I have for you is Senate Bill 224, which is an attempt, I think, to bring a little bit of common sense and sanity back to our campaign finance laws. I can just tell you, I've been doing elections now for 10 years. I think I've run at least 8 elections, some of them very expensive elections, and I think I know the campaign finance rules probably as well as anybody else, but there's been things over time that I think need to be corrected, and that's what this bill is. It's an attempt to really restore a little bit of balance here for the candidate, and at the same time to really protect kind of the procedures and the policies that we want with campaign finance disclosure. So let me walk you through the bill. I think that's the best way to go through this bill. So if you go to page 3, the first change we're making here is to allow you to have a fundraising event or some kind of political activity at a person's property without that counting as a contribution. And the reason for that is there was a decision under the previous commissioner that said you received a contribution when you had a fundraiser at a law firm's office. You know, you would have under the interpretation of that, you would receive a donation if you had a political rally at somebody's farm, if that was organized as a corporation. So this is just an attempt to clean that up and allow you to have a fundraiser at somebody's house or maybe at a law firm without having to worry about whether they gave you a contribution. The next change we have is on page 9. This is so section 2 of the bill pertains to the 48-hour notices. I think everyone here knows about the 48-hour notices. What I've done here is I've raised the threshold for disclosure. So for a legislative candidate, it's $125 now instead of $100. And the disclosure only runs through the day before the election. And the reason for that is I don't know what good it does to get the 48-hour notice 2 days after the election's over. So I think a common sense change, and of course we raise it up to $250 for the statewide people, obviously because they receive higher donation numbers. the next change on page 3, and I think this is probably the most important part of the bill. First, I've raised the disclosure limit from $30 to $50. This number hasn't kept up with inflation over the years, so we've just raised it up. And obviously, as the contribution limits have gone up, that number hasn't gone up as well. But I think most importantly, we're striking out in K, on page 12, the power of the commissioner to keep adding categories of information to the forms. When I first started, the form looked like the statute here. Now, when I went to fill out my form, I'm given quantities of stamps and number of signposts and content of my mailers. I don't know about you, but I didn't realize we hired the commissioner to be the stamp police and to make sure that they had the number of posts you bought. So, I mean, I think this is ultimately a legislative branch question. If we want the commissioner to count quantities and to provide us with content of mailers and every other category that seems to go into this form now that never ends, we should do it here in a bill. It shouldn't be something that's decided by rule without legislative involvement, and that's what's gone on. And I'd like to point out something too, because you're going to hear this, that we're going to ruin the ability of them to investigate. This is a statute that pertains to the forum, subpart 1 on page 11. The reports required must contain here. There's nothing in here about investigations. The commissioner has power to investigate, and that statute has not been changed with this bill. On 13, I think this is a nice one. I think the key part is in 4. I know that in some candidates, the party will, for example, hire staff, and that will count as a contribution to you. What we're saying here with this is that the candidate does not need to report staff time or contributions by the party if the party reported it. So that just cleans it up and makes it easier for everybody there. 11 is just a clarification, on page 14 in section 4, just another clarification as to what an incidental committee is. That's a paperwork requirement for people that maybe give donations through a business or something. And then I think really the big part is section 5. We're eliminating one statute that is unconstitutional. That's the naming of labeling of political parties. That statute was declared unconstitutional. And the next one, the aggregate PAC limit, that is a statute that is unconstitutional. It is clearly unconstitutional. There is a U.S. Supreme Court case that says aggregate donation limits are unconstitutional. And that applies to aggregate donation limits on PACs, PAC contributions. We have an arbitrary number. I think it's like $1,600 for House people, $3,000 for Senate. It probably doesn't even cover the cost of doing one mailing, and we're getting rid of that aggregate PAC limit. So with this, you will be treated just like a candidate for governor or attorney general. You will be able to take PAC contributions without worrying about hitting that aggregate PAC limit. So that's the bill. I don't think we're doing anything that's really radical, to be honest. It's just bringing a little bit of common sense here back to our campaign finance laws. So with that, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Fitzpatrick. Calling now for proponents for Senate Bill 224. We have any proponents in the room for Senate Bill 224? Ms. Street, are there any proponents online for Senate Bill 224?
Madam Chair, there are no proponents online.
Okay, thank you. Seeing none, we'll proceed to opponents for Senate Bill 224 in the room first. Welcome, Commissioner Mangan.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I may.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Mangan, M-A-N-G-A-N, Commissioner of Political Practices. This is, Senate Bill 224 is one of those bills that it's kind of a potpourri of a number of different items it's attempting to revise or change, some of which we support, many of things which we oppose, and a number of which are certainly legislative policy decisions. And hopefully we can shed some light on that as you make those decisions. So with that, as far as the exemption of property, Ms. McNaughton will be online here, and she will address that part. We oppose that part. We believe that there is a conflict with another prohibition found in 1335-227, and Ms. McNaughton will address that. In regards to the increase from $35 to $50, we feel that is certainly a legislative policy decision for your body, as well as the 48-hour rule from 100 to 125, and I can't believe what the other number was that Senator Fitzpatrick brought to you. We do have, however, as Senator Fitzpatrick described, do have concerns removing the language that allows us to ask for additional information to determine the source of contributions and expenditures. We respectfully disagree with the good senator. We do believe that that hampers our ability in investigations to ensure that we have all the information necessary when making determinations should a complaint come into us and whether to accept the complaint, and then further regarding the investigation. The naming and labeling statute, you've heard from this committee before. We were a supporter of an earlier bill that that you had heard, and the committee had also turned that into a committee bill that included the repeal of the naming and labeling statute. So obviously, we would be in support of that. The eliminating, again, there's just a number of different things within this bill. Eliminating aggregate political contributions. Ask, again, we heard about in a previous bill that this committee had heard based on a referendum that the public passed on campaign finance limits. Ms. McNaughton, again, will discuss that. We believe the proper would be to increase those limits, but again, that's a legislative policy decision. Senator Fitzpatrick asked that the bill be amended in the Senate, and he added two amendments on 13 and 14, one of which we support. Let me find it here. I'm not sure. Regarding if the political party reports staff, it's not necessary for the candidate to. However, the second part of reporting the expenditure within the window right prior to an election, we would adamantly oppose. That went on. Again, just the Disclose Act, when it was passed, was basically for an open window, transparency for all political spending, and political contributions between elections. And the Disclose Act is set up so right up to an election, any individual can find out the spending and or contributions received by a candidate or political committee. What this would do, by exempting this one section of staff, say a political party, either political party decided to hire a number of people to go out and canvass on 3 days before the election. That wouldn't have to be reported under this bill now until the following report, thus limiting the transparency of all those transactions the way the Disclose Act is set up between elections. And we think that's a big a big leap, not one that I don't believe that the legislature intended. We understand it could be problematic for parties or others to have to report that information, particularly if it's a large expenditure, but that's exactly the reason you passed the Disclose Act in 2015, to have that disclosure prior to an election. Exactly the reason. If that's okay, why are we having to disclose other expenditures during that period? And I don't want. I mean, it's a loophole, in my opinion, that could get bigger and bigger. I don't believe that's. It's certainly not what the legislature intended with the passage of the Disclose Act, and I certainly want to see that happen under this bill. And just let me talk about the forms. And just to give some context, when we first heard this in the Senate, I wasn't sure what bill or what the good senator would be referring to when asking for a couple of these changes. And when he talked about the detail and the reporting requirement in the bill or in that we require because of rule, I think it's important for us to explain how that works. So if I may, one more time, Madam
Yes,
Chair.
Yes, Commissioner. Go ahead.
After the Disclose Act was passed in 2015, there was certainly a lot of rulemaking. And as you've heard, I know you've heard plenty of rulemaking bills in this committee prior to hearing this one. So you certainly understand how the rulemaking process worked. And that's what the office did prior to my involvement, prior to my tenure as commissioner. The previous commissioner, Commissioner Modell, was here during the Disclose Act, and him and his staff created rules and proposed rules that the legislature ultimately accepted. And part of those rules included, you'll see number 7, if you just go to the rules, number 7, for the purposes of disclosure requirements, the purpose of each expenditure as reported on the Commissioner's campaign finance reporting forms shall specifically describe the purpose, quantity, subject matter as appropriate to each expenditure and must be detailed enough to distinguish among expenditures for similar purposes. For example, 2 expenditures for direct mail advertisements should not be both reported as flyers. In 2016, a couple of complaints came in that the previous commissioner ruled on that involved the detail requirement. It was ruled that they failed a sufficiency finding, that they failed to follow the detail requirement. However, it was dismissed because of excusable neglect because of the first time it was introduced. Following that, in 2017 or in 2018, my office received a number of, I want to say, close to 25 complaints on this very issue from one individual against a number of candidates from one party. We went through and went through each one of those complaints and addressed it the same way that the previous commissioner had done, pointing out that in 2016, this was a new rule. It needs to be followed. However, it's dismissed because of excusable neglect because it was a new rule, and went through all that. As part of that process, one of the things I learned was my office at the time, and no offense to the previous commissioner because I know he's here, didn't do a very good job about education and didn't do a good job of going out there and explaining to folks what type of things they needed to be reported. And that was one of my goals when I was appointed 4 years ago, and I think we've done a fairly decent job of that. Educated on this rule in particular because of those 25 complaints. And as part of that, listening to those 25 candidates, one of the things they said was, Commissioner, that information isn't even on the form. And so as you can see by the rule and by the law, it tells us it needs to be on the form. So we undertook a fairly significant undertaking to change the form online in the search process because everybody has to file online. So when a candidate files this information, it's literally right. You all have gone through it, I'm sure. It's step by step: quantity, description, purpose, etc. You can't miss it. The other thing we did is we put in the law, a link to the law in CSRS, and we put a link to this ARM, so you understand where it came from. So in response to this, again, with all due respect to the senator, I cannot pick and choose which laws and rules to enforce. I just can't. I can't. Well, I think that's silly. I think that's, you know, that's too much. That's overreach. That's not my job. And I understand he wants to change that, but I don't think he does it through this particular bill. I've also told the good senator, I'm in the Senate hearing, and I'm going to say it again, I'm going to say it to this committee, I stand ready to work with the senator and the interim SAVA committee, because we're going to have to be bringing, there's a number of bills this session, going to have to be bringing rules, and would more than happy to address any concerns surrounding this particular rule, working with not only the good senator, but the SAVA committee, to make sure it meets, it allows for transparency, and allows for full disclosure, but it does not nitpick or get into the weeds, or whatever, however you want to characterize that some folks think the bill does. Putting it like the way the senator has, I don't think does, respectfully, I don't think does that. But I am more than ready to stand with you and work on that rule to make sure it happens. Just let me give you an example. I've had a number of, let me just say, in 20, since we've done that, since we did the education piece, and since we added that additional detail, you know, that I should say, that the call for additional detail on the form that you find in CSRS, this last year we had only 3 complaints, had a formal complaint about detail versus the 30 plus probably in the prior couple of years. And two were within one campaign, one primary, one general. So I think we've done our jobs as far as making that easier and limiting the type of complaints that we saw in 2018 and earlier. I don't believe that the legislature wants, if a candidate places mailers, $20,000 on their campaign finance report, I don't believe there's one candidate in this room that wouldn't say, Commissioner, why are you letting him get away with that? What does that mean? You want to know what your opponent's doing. The public wants to know what folks are spending, and not necessarily on a large, it's not specific down to the stamps, and we address that in all of those 25-plus decisions during that year. But certainly, if you remove this, that's what you're opening yourself up to. Candidates and others, committees, reporting, advertising, $50,000. Advert mailers, $10,000. And that's just not enough information for the citizens and for candidates and committees to properly understand what campaigns are spending on. We can certainly have a disagreement as far as whether it's, you know, whether that's what the purpose of the Disclose Act is. I'd say it certainly was, but I certainly understand if you think it gets down too far, we can certainly address that in rule. And again, I'm more than happy to do that. Madam Senator, thank you for bringing these issues to my attention. I appreciate that. I would ask that you respectfully table this bill and allow us to work with the interim committee and the senator on those rule changes going forward. A number of the things that was discussed in this bill could be handled in rule. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Mangan. Further opponents. Further opponents for Senate Bill 224. Welcome, former Commissioner Motel.
Yes, Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee, Senator. I rise in opposition to Senate Bill 224. And I want to first address the new Section 5 repealing 1337218, which is the aggregate pack limit law. That law was passed by the 1983 Montana legislature. It's been in place for 38 years, 19 candidate cycles, and it has achieved its original purpose during that time, which for legislative candidates in the state of Montana, approximately 25% of the money that a candidate receives comes from human beings and not from political committees. That was the purpose, and that's what it's done over the last 19 cycles. Now, the reason offered is that the it should be repealed because it's unconstitutional. That reason is dead wrong. The law has been in place, as I said, for 38 years. It was challenged by James Bopp out of Indiana, and in 2003, upon appeal, the Ninth Circuit Court said specifically, we hold that Montana's interest in purging corruption and the appearance of corruption from its electoral system is sufficiently important to withstand constitutional scrutiny, and that MCA 1337218 are closely tailored to achieving those ends. We therefore affirm the district court and hold that those statutes are constitutional and do not violate the First Amendment. The citation is in footnote 3 or footnote 2 of my prepared testimony. Now, the case cited that the good senator has cited is McCutcheon. It came later, but in 2017, this statute was challenged again. It was again brought before the Ninth Circuit. That was in Lair v. Model, and it was again found to be constitutional. There was an appeal made to the Supreme Court. That was Lair v. Manigan. It was denied. The statute is unquestionably constitutional, and the reason it is constitutional and that differentiates it from any law that the good senator may cite is this. It does not regulate what PACs give. It regulates what legislators receive. And therein lies a huge distinction. It doesn't interfere with the speech rights of those political committees. They can go ahead and give whatever they want. It regulates what candidates receive. That's why it's been sustained as constitutional twice. Now, I go back a little bit on this. I was the floor lobbyist for Common Cause in 1983. I actually drafted this particular law. It was a bill, of course, at the time it was drafted. So I lobbied for that bill in 1983. I defended it from repeal by the legislature in 85, again in 87. I also testified at the first hearing before the U.S. District Court in Billings as one of the state's witnesses. It was a Democrat Attorney General at that time, McGrath, who brought that lawsuit. And I again, as Commissioner of Political Practices, submitted information to the court when it was reconsidered. Because of that, I will say this. I know it is constitutional. I am the attorney who's been involved in this in the state of Montana more than anybody else. I will say also this. I am the citizen who has been involved in this particular law, the most probably of any citizen in the state of Montana. I have never heard a citizen speak against this law. They didn't appear and speak against it when there were issues brought before the legislature. They're not here today against it. This is a particular law that serves citizens, and I would submit it serves you too, because you are here with citizen money, not with special interest money. I think it keeps our system good. It is a good law. I just would urge you not to take away 38 years of history and repeal this law for a wrong reason. The second reason I appear primarily today is that law that would take away the ability of the commissioner's office to generically deal with issues that it wishes disclosed, and our commissioner spoke eloquently on it today, and it is one of the great achievements of his office is dealing with this particular issue. But my concern is this. I was the commissioner in a time of crisis, and many of you weren't here then, but it was a true time of crisis because the Republican primaries were under siege from an outside interest, the National Right to Work Committee. And they came in and were funding one candidate in the Republican primary against the others, and I stepped into the office. We had all those complaints, Republican against Republican. They had to be dealt with. The office wouldn't have had any credibility if they weren't dealt with. I ended up filing the first enforcement action in the history of the office, and I ended up filing the 26th enforcement action in the history of the office. One of those was a case against a legislator which went to a full district court trial in 2017 here in Helena. There were 20-plus pretrial motions aimed at the authority of the commissioner's office to bring that enforcement action. You take away this generic authority to get information, it undermines the ability of the commissioner's office to have regulations to do enforcement. It's a subtle change, but it's important change. Now, hopefully, never will a commissioner have to do that kind of enforcement again. It wasn't fun when it happened. And it wasn't fun for anybody. And maybe we'll never have to see that sort of thing again. But this change where you take away this regulation, and I don't doubt the senator's reasons for doing it, but it will undermine enforcement in the future. And the only other thing I would speak on, because I just heard this for the first time today, so that law firm issue an opinion was issued during my tenure, and I hate to say I wrote those opinions because I really didn't singularly write those commissions during my time. There were almost 200 of them written, but they were all heavily vetted. I would draft them, and just like the current commissioner, they would then be vetted by an assistant attorney general, by Jamie McNaughton on the staff, by the other members of the staff. So really they're collective decisions when you see them, even though there's one person's name on them. They're the office's decision. So that law firm decision reflected this. That law firm brought in a candidate fundraiser event, but it had the thing lavishly outfitted. I mean, there was a caterer there with great food. There was liquor. They were way over the limit. The statute says anything of value. Forget the real estate. Look at the value of what they were providing the candidates. They were way over it. They had to report as a political committee. And as far as a home goes, anything you do in your home is exempt. That is not anything of value. It's exempted under current law. You can go ahead and have that fundraiser in your home. You don't report or disclose that, and you're not expected to. You're a human being. But it's a different thing when you have it done commercially. So I would submit to you that this is a bill that, and I've known the senator, and like everybody else, I've had wonderful discussions with him, but this is a bill that I totally agree with the current commissioner. Whatever the merits are in the bill, you should sit down and deal with it in a different setting and not pass this thing. This is a bad bill, and I would hope you table it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Model. Mr. Model, one more thing. Did we get spelling of his name? Before we hear our next witness, I'd like to have that for the record, please.
I apologize. I haven't been back in front of the legislature for two sessions. This is the first time. Jonathan, J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N, Model, M-O-T-L. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, next opponent for Senate Bill 224.
Madam Chairwoman, there's members of the committee, Mark Mackin. I am have a long time interest in, pardon me while I restore my hearing.
Okay.
My name is Mark Mackin, M-A-R-K-M-A-C-K-I-N. I appear in opposition to at least several aspects of this bill. The ones that has been discussed the most, repealing 1327-218, guts the campaign finance laws, as far as I'm concerned. You're going to end up having all kinds of PACs giving you money. And it creates a loyalty question. It creates suspicion on the part of the public as to who you owe your loyalty to. it raises the specter of the Wittig investigation, where you had legislators or candidates for legislature signing secret loyalty pacts to a non-governmental organization, take in return for money from that organization and other assistance. That kind of thing just has to be extinguished. And it's really, for most of you, it's not a matter of breaking the law that creates a problem. It's the appearance of corruption when there is so much money sloshing around in the system and it looks like you're being bought. And people don't know who's buying you. It really weakens the public faith in our whole electoral system, and it weakens the public's faith in you. I note that it doesn't repeal candidate limits on candidate contributions from PACs. That's interesting, but I don't know what to do with that. As far as deleting on page 12, line 25, deleting disclosure of other information, that kind of generic information gathering that was discussed, definitely not okay. It removes the ability of your police person to enforce the law, to follow up on violations of the law. Just kind of hamstrings, you know, defund the police is a concept. This is one way to defund the police. I'm a defense counsel. I'm sitting there with my client during the with the state's investigator, Mr. Mangan's investigator, and a question is asked that goes outside of that list of information A through J, and I tell my client, don't answer that question. You're not required to answer that question, because the legislature specifically deleted that authority in 2021. And you can go to court on that if you want, but it's a meritorious defense. And it'll take 6 months. And you'll be litigating every single investigation. The commissioner's investigation will be hamstrung. It will be limited to A through J. And if they can't find anything, they're done. The prosecution against Wittig would have been impossible. So I think that that's just, you know, there's no point, what point is there in having a commissioner with a genuine police power if you're going to hamstring them that way. Item 3, page 3, line 10, exempt reporting the use value of a person's real property. I have some questions to ask about that. You know, are we talking person corporation or person individual? And when is property personal? Or when is it used commercially? That's probably going to be litigated. And it's very common for politicians to be invited to various kinds of gatherings of one sort or another. The whole point, of course, is to, you know, change your mind or make up your mind on various issues that are going to be coming before you as a legislator. This is a standard practice, especially for people who have lots of resources. Doesn't matter whether it's NGOs or unions or corporations or whatever, to get access, and it makes a big difference. The use of those kinds of properties is a standard lobbying and advocacy practice, and I think all you have to do now is go on the web, find an equivalent property on offer, whether it's a French chateau or a big sky ski place or something like that. Those are all priced. It's not that hard. It's not that difficult to comply. As far as the disclosure thresholds, that's a discretionary thing. obviously, anytime you loosen the standards, that, in a technical sense, damages, but we've also got practical considerations. So moving those numbers may make sense. As far as repealing the truth in labeling, we tried. It didn't work. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mackin. Further opponents for Senate Bill 224, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Katiana Stutzer, K-A-T-J-A-N-A, S-T-U-T-Z-E-R, here on behalf of the Montana Public Interest Research Group, or MOPIRG. Thank you for your time this morning. I will keep it brief. I think the other opponents have very nicely detailed some of the concerns that we also share in this bill. We rise in opposition of Senate Bill 224, and primarily I want to highlight for repealing those aggregate PAC limits that put more money in our elections and primarily benefit special interests and not the people of Montana, limiting the power of the COPP to investigate violations, as well as sort of blurring those lines on fundraisers and the property that those can occur on, which we think opens the door for some mischief in that area. And we all know that Montana has a long legacy of some of the strictest campaign finance laws in the nation, because we as Montanans have said that we value transparent elections that represent the interests of the people in our state and not the interests of special interest groups can afford to buy our elections. And we, MOPIRG, believes that Senate Bill 224 is not in the interest of everyday Montanans, and we would urge a no vote on this bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Stutzer. Further opponents? There are none on site, so we're ready for the ones online. So,
Madam Chair, I have three.
Okay, thank you.
I will start out with Michelle.
Okay. Welcome, Ms. Zizian.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Michelle Zizian from Gardner. To the citizens of Montana, SB 224 is just a bad bill. Perhaps most disturbing is that the bill removes the aggregate PAC limit for legislators and allows them to take unlimited corporate donations for their campaigns. And this just puts more out-of-state big money and influence in Montana politics. The bill also does take away the investigative powers of the commissioners of political practices, allowing for dark money and illegal coordination to take place without any accountability. You know, SB 224 really comes off as legislator corruption, and I believe your vote for SB 224 will be a vote for corruption. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Zizian. Mr. Pearson?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll keep my comments really, really brief. I want to state my opposition. I was around in 1983 when the initial bill was discussed. And the initial bill for the PAC limit law, aggregate PAC limit is what I want to talk about. There's other provisions that can be addressed, that have been addressed. But at the point in time, nearly 40 years ago, political action committees were not predominant in Montana, but they were gaining influence. And at that point, we studied and had a report out that there were, you know, members of the legislature who were receiving upwards of 90% of their campaign contributions from political actions committees. And the trend was just not good. And we've had that problem in other states. So, rightly so, Republicans and Democrats stepped in together to try to keep our elections fair. And that was the aggregate PAC limit. It stood the test of time. if you can imagine the removal of that particular provision, we would have political action committee funding in primaries and in general elections that could be off the charts, frankly. Even though they have individual limits, we had candidates in the early 80s who were receiving nearly all of their money from different political action committees and very little from individual contributors. And so our history is to make sure that special interests, the copper collar, doesn't really dominate our elections at the state legislature. So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Pearson, would you mind please giving us the spelling?
Oh, yes. Sorry, Madam Chair. C.B. Pearson, P-E-A-R-S-O-N.
And are you affiliated with anyone, sir?
No, I'm speaking on behalf of myself as a volunteer. I've been active with a number of citizen groups here, including the Common Cause.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pearson.
Thank you.
Okay. Next opponent to Senate Bill 224, Ms. McNaughton, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jamie McNaughton, J-A-I-M-E, M-A-C, capital N-A-U, G-H-T-O-N, and I am Chief Legal for the Office of the Commissioner of Political Practices. I'm going to try not to repeat what's been said before. I got to kind of summarize here.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We all appreciate that.
Not used to having two commissioners in the room. Senate Bill 224 exempts the use of real property for fundraising from the definition of contribution or expenditure. And as previous people have pointed out, that actually runs into conflict with the prohibition on receipt of contributions from corporations or unions. And so for those reasons, we oppose it. I would agree with former Commissioner Modell about the McCutcheon standard was already applied to our aggregate contribution limits and upheld as ours. Our law is upheld as constitutional. It is in no way unconstitutional. Regarding the discussion about passing of the rules following the Disclose Act with no legislative oversight, I'm going to disagree. I led that rulemaking. We spent 2 months coming up with what we thought would be the 10 most controversial rules. And before we even introduced those rules, we had a pre-vetting group to get together and talk about whether or not these rules were within what the Disclose Act had. We then went back and proposed the changes to all of the rules and reorganized them to follow the flow of a campaign. It was an extensive, huge rulemaking that we did. We worked with the SAVA committee. The SAVA committee ended up voting to pause our ability to pass those rules until I think it was like November. We had over 2 days of public comment and notice and input on that, and we sat down and we worked hard on making those rules fit within legislative intent. And we actually ended up surviving a legislative goal that all of our rules were found to have been within the legislative intent of the Disclose Act, including the one that's being, you know, challenged here and saying that you did want quantity, purpose, and numbers. And that all of these were challenged and have been upheld not only by the legislature, but also down the road. We've gone through U.S. District Court, Ninth Circuit, and the Supreme Court of the United States several times. So I disagree that we did not have any legislative oversight. It was in the fall of 2015, and we went at the same time that the Department of Revenue was having their rule challenged. We survived it. We stayed within the limits of what the legislature had passed, as you affirmed. And with that, I will stand for any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McNaughton. Are there any further opponents for Senate Bill 224? Seeing none, are there any informational witnesses for Senate Bill 224? There are none on site, and there are none online. I'll do one more call for informational witnesses for Senate Bill 224. Seeing none, we'll proceed with questions from the committee. Representative Grieve, Vice Chair Grieve.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the sponsor.
Senator Fitzpatrick, please.
Yes.
Thank you, Senator. The issue of investigations has been brought up. Could you respond to that, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Grieve. That's a good question. You know, I heard a lot about investigations. I heard a lot about how we're not going to be able to crack down on people like Representative Wittig. I got to tell you, what was interesting in the discussion is nobody mentioned the powers that the commissioner has right now to investigate and how those powers aren't affected by the statute. And since they didn't want to talk about the investigatory statute, I'm going to read it to you. So this is not in the bill, of course, because it's not being amended, but the statute, if you want to look it up, is 1337111. Investigative powers and duties. Except as provided in this section, the commissioner is responsible for investigating all of the alleged violations of election laws contained in Title 35. The commissioner may investigate all statements filed pursuant to the provisions of Title 35. So he has all that power. But I think this is even more interesting. Nobody wanted to say this right here. The commissioner may inspect any records, accounts, or books that must be kept pursuant to the provisions of Title 35 of this chapter or this chapter that are held by any political committee or candidate as long as the inspection is made during reasonable office hours. So all this stuff that you're hearing about investigations, how they won't be able to investigate campaign finance complaints, how they won't be able to get the paperwork, it's just a bunch of nonsense. All it is a red herring to try and keep you off the bill. I mean, I just read you the statute. They can get all the documents they want. And this idea that somehow they need to know the quantities in order to catch people like it was the early complaints from the 2000s or the early part of the 2000s, all of those complaints were investigated and most of them were resolved prior to the time the commissioner adopted this administrative rule on the quantities. They had all the power to do it then. Nothing is changing with this bill. This bill isn't affecting their investigative power at all. What this bill does is it goes into the form you submit to the commissioner, and it takes away that power to continually add more with rules. And I know they like the rule, but, I mean, do you think that we should be putting down the number of quantities of stamps or the number of signposts you bought or the pieces of plywood? That's a decision we should make here and right here. And that's what we're here. We are the legislative branch. We should decide whether that's something we want to do. We shouldn't just say, well, they had a rule hearing and we're just supposed to give away our authority now. We're done. The commissioner had a rulemaking process. So, no, we should decide that. If we want to do quantities, it should be in the statute. You know, that's what this is about. So, the stuff about investigations is just so wrong. I mean, I can't believe I'm even hearing it. So, I would appreciate a pass when we get to this one. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Madam Chair.
Okay. Further questions from the committee? Representative Heyman.
Madam Chair, Representative Karjala actually was waiting before I was.
Thank you very much. Representative Karjala.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. My question, Madam Chair, is for former Commissioner Modell, please.
Mr. Modell, please.
Representative, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioner and or Mr. Modell. My question relates to the ability to investigate in light of the bill sponsor's previous comments. So I want to give you a hypothetical situation. Say my very wealthy friend wanted to donate to the max amount to all of the members of the Democratic Party who are running for the legislature. If this bill were to pass, would that impair the commissioner's ability to investigate something like that? And can you explain how and what the implications of that would be?
If the bill passes, it would impact the commissioner's ability to investigate anybody who said you do not have the authority to investigate because your rule, the information you're seeking isn't covered by a specific rule and you lack generic authority to require disclosure of a particular type of information. Does that happen? Of course it happens. It happened in any time you go to enforce in the particular trial that we went to a jury trial on, and as you know, the commissioner's office did prevail with about $100,000 in fines eventually. Fines went to the general fund. The motions that were filed were, we of course requested the information. The person refused. We're not going to provide that information. You do not have the authority to ask us to provide that information. Show us where you have that authority. It's a motion. You go respond to it. You file before the judge. The judge makes a decision. We did win all of those motions. But even when we won, we didn't get the information. We had to get the information from third parties. The final response was, well, you won the motion, but we don't have any information. So perhaps in the day-to-day work, Representative Cargella, given that almost everybody in Montana, during the time I was commissioner, and I'm sure under the current commissioner, I was constantly humbled by the way legislators responded when we asked them something. They would show up with everything in a box on their campaign. They'd give us everything. We went through it. We were able to resolve it. But there were the exceptions where we're not going to give you anything. You don't have any authority to request anything. And there you are. You're having to fall back on your full authority to require information to come to the commissioner's office, and you're enforcing it through a court. So in your hypothetical example, Representative Cargella, if the person who gave the money refused to give you that information and said you lack the authority, this change would definitely affect the ability of the commissioner to go to the courts and seek that information in the only way he had left or she had left, which was to use the court system. Does that answer your question, Representative?
It does. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Modell. Okay, Representative Heyman, further questions from the committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Ms. McNaughton.
Ms. McNaughton, please.
Madam Chair, Ms. McNaughton, we heard the sponsor state that in Statute 13, I hope I wrote this correctly, Statute 1337111, that you have all the authority you need to analyze, assess, do review of a campaign donation. Could you speak to that, please?
Madam Chair, Representative Heyman, the way the statute is written, it does give us investigative authority. However, there's been a court determination at the First Judicial District Court, which now says that we have to go to the district court and get a subpoena issued in order to be able to even look at a campaign or committee's documents. Early last year that decision was made. Of course, we've got that on appeal to the Montana Supreme Court, and we're waiting a determination from them. But right now, what it's doing is it's hamstringing us. We can ask for compliance and giving us the documents. We can try and make these decisions on the ground before voters go to the polls. But as Commissioner Modell said, if we are forced to go into court and obtain those subpoenas and then go be able to get the documents, it lengthens the process. The public doesn't get the answer before they go to the polls.
and it ends up taking a lot more time on the part of the commissioner's office. I mean, we want these things decided and being reliable at the administrative level and not requiring us to go into court and requiring political committees or candidates to go into court. So it's hamstrung right now, and this bill would further hamstring our ability.
Thank you, Ms. McNaughton and Madam Chair.
Okay, are there further questions from the committee? Representative Custer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for Mr. Mangan.
Commissioner Mangan, please.
Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Custer.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Mangan, I'm looking at this sheet of opposition. So on here, what could we work out that so this would be more workable? I was wondering about, you know, the repeal of the...
Let's take one question at a time, yeah. And we'll let him answer that.
Well, I haven't got it to the specific of this one. I'm just wondering about the repeal on the limits, the aggregate limits. Maybe if we don't repeal it, could we raise it maybe and still be... It raise that limit, because that hasn't been raised in, well, basically 38 years, or maybe it's went up with inflation. I'm not a little bit, but it's still not keeping up with what it costs to run an election now. So on that, would you have any trouble with that if we just raised the limit and didn't repeal it totally?
Madam Chair, Representative Custer, you know, we believe that's a legislative decision, a policy decision.
Okay.
And I, if I may, Madam Chair, Representative Custer, we did ask for a number of amendments in the Senate, asked to work with the sponsor, the sponsor, to my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, good Senator, wasn't receptive to the amendments. So.
Okay.
Follow-up for
Madam Chair and Commissioner Mangan. We've heard about the on the 13-37-111 and the fact that you have to now go to get a subpoena before you can get the evidence you want with things the way we have them now. So if we don't have all the amounts, say in the on down in the thing where we have to put the amount, kind of what the brochure's about or the card's about, all that, is that really going to change anything? Because that's about, if we have a little bit less information there, is it still going to change the deal, needing a subpoena, which the court decided that on their out of the goodness of their heart, I guess.
Madam Chair, Representative Custer, we have been very lucky, and I think it's because of Montana and Montanans and Montana candidates. We've only had to, during my tenure, I can't speak for any previous commissioner, have only asked had to go to that very last step of asking for a subpoena one time. We've been very lucky to be able to work with candidates and requesting information, things. While the good senator talks about, you know, just shocked that this, you know, that we wouldn't have that power. Well, again, I'll point, it's what power you give us and what items you ask us for. You're basically asking for the basically what's in the report. You know, I can't overstep that. Coordination complaints or coordination issues. The good senator read the statute. Doesn't say anything about communications. The communication I may need, the email from the candidate to the committee to the vendor talking about coordinating on sharing an expenditure on an election communication, for example, as my one of the large things I'm in, our office is currently undertaking now and a number of incidental committees, trying to determine whether a committee is truly incidental or not, a large number of expenditures outside of their primary purpose to make sure we're determining what the primary purpose of that committee is, certainly not reportable within the lines of the law allows us to do that and ask those questions, make those determinations prior to either making a decision of whether or not we should even take the, to accept the complaint. So, and I'll just remind you that, you know, we've talked a lot about candidates.
I mean, there's 150 legislators. There's lots of committees wanting to spend millions of dollars to change the people's minds on a number of issues that you may have already passed and change that in law, or change our constitution that has, you know, political committees putting lots of money in. And so it's not just about whether or not a senator in 2016 got a complaint because she didn't report six stamps. It's much, much bigger than that, with all due respect. It's about, you know, the committee that's putting $5 million to change our constitution. I mean, so we're both advocates, and I so much appreciate the good senator's advocacy and for his position, and you can see that, and it's very much appreciated. But we also have a responsibility, and it's more than just that detail that was on the form, because we've never had to do it before, and I explained why we changed the form, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Further questions from the committee? Representative Walsh.
Madam Chair, a question for Commissioner Mangum.
Commissioner Mangum, please.
Madam Chair, good representative.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, by having the disclosure and that information out there on a website and available, do you think that provides some reduction in inquiries or things that would cause your office to require investigations because people know that that's information is there and what it is all about, and that then there wouldn't be so many inquiries or investigations by your staff?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a good question. I believe that's exactly correct. I mean, that's exactly why we spend the time trying to educate and getting folks to look deeper into the information that's on the reports, because they'll answer their questions. I mean, you can go into any of your reports. Those questions are answered if the citizen wants that information, and that's the beauty of Montana's system. And there's oftentimes we have to direct folks to the campaign finance report or to a certain section of the report, and it happens quite routinely that, oh, thank you, I didn't realize it was there, and it doesn't end up in a complaint. And when we do our inspections, and I know folks, you know, they love our staff, but they hate the inspection process. The only reason we do inspections is to avoid complaints. So those things that were done, and you know, those complaints that were delivered in 2018 aren't delivered in 2020 because you've done it correctly. And I guess I could continue to talk on that, but I hope that answers your question. Yes, indeed. And I think it's in it. And if I dare say, Montanans have, and candidates and committees have come to expect it. So,
a follow-up, Representative Walsh.
Madam Chair, Commissioner. So what happens if somebody just puts down that they spent $10,000 on brochures? Can you investigate at that point, or do you have to wait for a complaint to be issued?
Madam Chair, Representative, good question. Currently, we can only investigate on when a complaint is delivered and accepted. But that being said, I just brought up the inspection process. When we come across those type, and we can't catch everyone. Believe me, 10,000 reports, three complaint specialists doing a scan. But we do come across those. That's why you get those emails back from my staff that says, you know, you may want to break that down into 10,000 candidate bio mailers for $4,550 or whatever that is. And that's those inspection reports that you get back. And then you can choose to whether you go back in and amend it. If you don't, and someone, an opponent or someone else doesn't understand that, files a complaint, then we're duty bound to investigate that. Madam Chair.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Hill.
Madam Chair, question for the sponsor.
Senator
Senator Fitzpatrick, I was hoping that you would touch a little bit more on the implied undermining of the power to investigate, please.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Hill, I mean, I think the commissioner just made a real telling statement when he said they don't have the power to investigate until they get a complaint. Well, once the complaint's triggered, then they have all that power under the statute I just read you. So this constant harping I've heard, and I heard it in the committee, and I heard it on the Senate floor, and now I'm hearing it, that the power to investigate is being ruined. It's, I mean, like I said, we are not touching the investigative powers. All I'm doing with the bill is changing the statute that pertains to the form, and I, for the life of me, I can't understand how it has been interpreted as giving them investigative powers. I mean, I'll read it to you. The reports required under these sections from candidates, ballot issue committees, political parties, and must meet these requirements. I don't see in here where that gives them authority to investigate. I mean, this is plain English reading. I mean, you can read it as well as I can read it. There's nothing in that sentence about investigations. So, and I think the commissioner said it. The investigation starts after the complaint is filed. After the complaint is filed, then he has all of that power in that code section I just wrote for you. So, like I said, back to the main theme, this we can't investigate. I don't think it's true. I think they have all the power to investigate. This bill doesn't touch any of the investigative powers. We're touching the form, the documents that you have to submit. And if we want to, like I said, I just want to go back to the same theme again. If we want to do quantities, if we want to do content, that should be a legislative decision. It should not be a decision made by an unelected government agency. This is a legislative function which goes on in this chamber, in this room, and we should decide right now what we want and what we don't want. And right now I have a bill that says we go back and have forms like we had in 2010 and 2012 and 2014 and 2016. Life was just fine then. We'll be fine with these forms. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. For the Madam Chair, Senator Fitzpatrick, thank you.
Any further questions from the committee? I do have a question for the sponsor, please, Senator Fitzpatrick. Senator Fitzpatrick, evidently there is a challenge to part of MCA Code 13-37-111, if the ruling on 13-37-111 hasn't been given, how is it hamstringing any kind of investigation in that statute?
Madam Chair, I think if I understand your question, you know, the powers to investigate are things in, that would be an issue for the legislature to resolve with that statute. If the courts have interpreted it one way and the commissioner thinks he needs to beef it up, he should just bring a bill in here that asks for a change in his investigatory power. I don't think that coming in here and trying to block this bill under the investigation theme has anything to do with whatever some district court ruled. Huh?
Okay. I think that answers my question, because to restate it, if the ruling hasn't been given, it would mean to me that this statute stands. And we could go forward with it. Would that not be true?
Madam Chair, there's so if I understand the question, I'm sorry, I don't think I understood your question. So my understanding is there is a district court decision which interpreted the investigation statute, and they apparently put limitations on what the commissioner can subpoena with documents. But I think that issue is irrelevant to this bill. This bill doesn't touch on that statute, and it doesn't touch on what the commissioner can and cannot get with a subpoena. If he's upset about how the district court ruled on the subpoena decision, then I think the proper remedy would be for him to bring a bill that fixes the court's interpretation of that statute, not, like I said, not coming in here and challenging whether the form should have quantities.
Thank you, Senator. Are there any further questions from the committee? If not, Senator, would you like to close on your bill?
I, I would. Just a couple other points that were made. I think they were really off the bill, and I was kind of disappointed to hear them, but I'll go through them. The first one about how we're going to have these big lavish parties at people's houses. If you, again, back to the bill text, it just talks about the use of real property. It doesn't say anything about the amount of food or drink or anything else that goes on at the fundraising event. It's just solely the use of the real property. And I hate to say it, but I think it is the practice of most people to have a fundraising event at somebody's law office or somewhere else, and I think we've unfortunately are just leading to more complaints. And ultimately, I think that's what this bill is about. It's trying to cut down on the number of complaints. I mean, there was a little reference into it, but a couple years ago, a Republican Party operative went and filed something like 20-plus complaints against Democratic candidates because they weren't doing stamps and all that kind of stuff. So, and I believe one of them, I think it was Senator Ellis, said she had a complaint filed against her for 89 cents of postage or something like that in the Senate. There was a couple other points here. The stuff about repealing the PAC limit is going to end up with corporate money. No, PACs are funded with individual donations. You can't put corporate money into a PAC and then give it to a candidate. So, and all of the PACs in the state of Montana are disclosed. If somebody's really worried about looking at the amount of or who the donors are to a PAC, it's right there on the commissioner's website. So you can go see who the donors to the PAC are and then say, that person got that PAC check, so we know who the donors are. Everybody knows who the donors are with the PACs. That's, we're not getting corporate money. I did talk about the issues with Representative Wittig. All of those things were raised and investigated prior to the time that the commissioner passed the rule on the quantities. So there shouldn't be a problem there. And then finally, I don't understand why you can sit here and say having an aggregate PAC limit for the legislature is somehow going to stop corruption or all these bad things when we don't have an aggregate PAC limit for the governor's race or the attorney general's race or the secretary of state's race. I mean, we're all candidates. Is the legislative process somehow more corrupting than the work of the secretary of state? I don't think so. There's no reason. It's just an arbitrary number. It doesn't make any sense. So I would hope you will pass this bill. I think this is a good bill, and I do think it brings a little bit of sanity back to our campaign finance laws. With that, thank you.
Thank you, Senator. This closes the hearing on Senate Bill 224. We'll now open the hearing on Senate Bill 226.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The last bill I have for you is Senate Bill 226. I should, for the record, Steve Fitzpatrick, Senate District 10. This is one, again, I think it's, lack of a better term, I think we'll, another where I think it's a regular practice that most people have done, and hopefully, well, many people, I guess I don't want to say most people, but I will say many people have done this. They have partially funded their campaign with loans, and they carry that loan balance over to the end of the campaign, and then they pay it off. There was recently a decision by the commissioner's office involving the governor, and if I understand the decision, the ruling was that in order to carry a loan balance into the future, you had to go and pay off all your all the loans in the primary, and then you would have to basically reloan yourself the money again in the general in order to do that. So what this bill simply says is you make the loan, as long as you pay off all the debts to everybody else except yourself, you can carry that loan balance into the future and then pay that loan off with primary and general election funds. So if you make the contribution to yourself, to your campaign, say you put in $300, you go through the campaign, and if you got 200 left, you can pay off part of your loan. I think this is how many candidates do it. I know after I've passed this bill, I've had many people come up and say that they appreciated this because this is what they did and this is what they thought the law was anyways. So with that, I would ask for your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. This time we'll have proponents for Senate Bill 226. Are there proponents for Senate Bill 226? Seeing none on site, we'll go to online. Are there any proponents for Senate Bill 226?
Madam Chair, there are no proponents.
Okay, thank you. Seeing none, we will go to opponents for Senate Bill 226.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Mangan, M-A-N-G-A-N, Commissioner of Political Practices. With your permission, Madam?
Yes, that'll be fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This won't take nearly as long as the last, and we'll get out of here. Luckily, it's a simple one-page bill. Our major concern with this bill is not the loan. We understand that candidates loan themselves money. And currently, what you can do, if you loan yourself $10,000, and at the end of the primary, you have $10,000, you can pay yourself back that $10,000 and re-loan yourself if you need another loan for the general going in. And when you do that, you can no longer receive primary contributions on your debt because you won't have any debt. Or if you have $10,000 and you still have that $10,000 loan, you could forgive the loan to yourself, move that money into the general. It becomes a general election. You can use in the general election, and again, you won't be able to raise primary election contributions on that. And that's the crux of the issue that we have with this bill, is that it's setting up just basically a new kind of debt. If you have leftover funds, you should pay off your primary debt, whether that's debt from that you paid to a vendor or the debt that you have from a loan. When you pay that off, you can currently under law, you can raise primary election contributions to pay off your debt as long as it exists. And what we're setting up here is basically the ability to continue to rate. You're going to be able to carry primary debt. You're moving that into the general election. You can still receive a campaign or fundraise for primary and general election contributions, use that by the way it's worded throughout the general election, and then kind of sort it out after the general election is over. And it's almost too simple in the way it's written based on how we have now. So if it's your intent to pass this bill, please have the discussion so we know what the legislative intent is on this, that it needs to be crystal clear that any primary contributions received after the transfer to the general election can only be received up to the amount of the primary debt less the primary contributions that were transferred. So it just has to be clear. We can't have a system where you're holding debt on this in this primary election, you're raising primary and general election contributions. The bookkeeping already is difficult, not only for you, but for us too, trying to figure that out. So just make sure crystal clear that you can't exceed primary contributions that's greater than the amount of debt you would have had if you would have paid it off when you moved it over to the general election. It's crystal clear to me. It's not, again, we disagree. We don't see eye to eye. It's unfortunate. I'm just glad they're back to back and not, you know, two separate. So the good senator, I only have to do this over an hour and a half. And then I would just point out the retroactivity. I think we have three decisions in the past couple of years that involve this, in a sense that we'd have to go back in and take a look at those primary contribution amounts versus the amount that was transferred over, then the amount that was left in as debt. We don't think there's a problem here. I know it's easier just to transfer, the money, but it's just as easy to pay yourself back, put another loan in for the general election, and move on. And if you have a large amount of debt and a large amount of loans, you can continue until you close that account to raise primary funds to pay that down. That's the reason you have, that's the reason that ability is there. So I would just strongly urge you to have a good discussion on this to make sure that primary contributions are for primary elections. primary debt. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, sir. Next opponent for Senate Bill 226.
Madam Chairman, Chairwoman, sorry, members of the committee, I oppose 266. I did not provide testimony.
Would you, please?
Sorry?
Introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm Mark Mackin, M-A-R-K-M-A-C-K-I-N is my name. Thank you. I oppose this bill mostly on a matter of principle rather than the technical issues that the commissioner brought up. It seems to me that what we've got here is some special legislation. The Constitution says no special legislation. It escapes that definition because there's no name attached to it. We're not doing a favor for supposedly a particular person. But in fact, it was our current governor who either couldn't figure out how to manage his campaign money or decided to just go ahead and make his own rules and go ahead and then got into difficulty. And now the expectation is the legislature is going to make it all good for him. Mr. Laszloff appeared earlier and mentioned that the legislature should jealously guard its power. I think that is really important. I think that you have a duty to hold others accountable, even the governor, and it's not your job to be nice. Just because you're in the same party, or just because you're friends, or just because you're all politicians together. I particularly object to the retroactive nature of it, specifically because it is actually special legislation to benefit one person, Greg Gianforte. Thank you.
Mr. Macklin, I do have two. I won't gavel you down, but it was really inappropriate for you to mention the governor in such terms, and I would avoid doing that in the future if I were you.
Thank you for the guidance, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, further opponents to Senate Bill 226. Further opponents to 226. Seeing none on site, are there any online?
Madam Chair, I have Jamie McNaughton.
Ms. McNaughton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jamie McNaughton. That's J-A-I-M-E, M-A-C, capital N-A-U-G-H-T-O-N. And I'm going to echo the commissioner's concerns. The main concern for us is that it results in a circumvention of contribution limits. Basically, candidates who are able to raise money, or candidates who are able to fund their own campaigns, would then be able to continue to raise funds without retiring the primary debt while still using those new funds, the primary and the general, only in their general election. That's our concern. We don't want anybody to have some sort of a special advantage over anybody else when they're running for office. So, thank you so much.
Did we lose you, Ms. McNaughton? I see.
Oh, I'm sorry, I finished. Madam Chair, I finished.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. McNaughton. Are there further opponents to Senate Bill 226?
Madam Chair, there are no further opponents.
Thank you. Okay, are there any informational witnesses for Senate Bill 226? Any informational witnesses? Seeing none, questions from the committee? Representative Rex, good.
Madam Chair, a question for Commissioner Mangan.
Commissioner Mangan, please.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioner Mangan. I, as the person who was the treasurer of her own campaign, I found it pretty unwieldy to, you know, have more money in my primary account than in my general account, and I got into a lot of problems in your computer program. Is there any way that you can deal with that? I mean, I know this bill touches on that, but I had no debt, but it made my balance look like it was in the negative.
Madam Chair, Representative, I will let you know right now that I will sit down, we will talk with you, we'll try to understand what your issue is, go back in and see if that is something that we can fix either through the computer program or in another fashion. We certainly want to, if there are those type of issues that may affect accounting, we certainly want to know, and we certainly want to make sure that they're addressed. And you have my word that I will sit down, chat with you, figure out what those concerns are, and investigate, and then fix as necessary, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Representative Heyman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question from Ms. McNaughton.
Ms. McNaughton.
Madam Chair, Representative Heyman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. McNaughton, I just want to be totally clear in my mind. So here's a scenario. A candidate lends himself $5,000 in the primary, acquires another $5,000 in campaign donations, wins their primary, and what you're requesting is that they pay off all the debt acquired during their primary and return the $5,000 personal loan. If they did not do that, how exactly is that going to impact their capabilities or not impact so much as give them kind of a advantage if they just rolled that money over in during the general election? If you could give something concrete example.
Madam Chair, Representative Heyman. Okay, so following your example, so the person still has $5,000 left at the end of their primary campaign and they have a $5,000 loan. They would then transfer the $5,000 debt of the primary to the general and the $5,000 from the primary left over. So they have an additional $5,000 right there. But then they would also be able to continue to raise money to extinguish that $5,000 debt. So they would get both a primary and a general contribution from people because that $5,000 was still outstanding. Does that make sense?
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes, follow-up, Representative Heyman.
So I think and this is my fourth term, so you'd think I'd have this nailed down, but so we're allowed donations during the primary of, I believe, $182. And that's the cutoff for the primary. And then in the general, if we move forward in the general, if there's an additional $182, let's say. And what you're implying is that if you can roll over the primary amount, it increases the amount of donations that you will benefit from in the general. Is that what's going on here?
Madam Chair, Representative Heyman. Yes, to a degree. So you would benefit in the general from the primary funds that you had already raised without extinguishing that debt. And then you would continue to be able to raise additional money, even though the primary election was over, to extinguish a debt that's outstanding. I know this gets complicated, but it allows you to continue to raise money for primary debt that you never extinguished, so you get both a primary contribution and a general contribution, and then can use it in the general.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. McNaughton.
Okay, further questions from the committee? Representative Walsh, please. Okay, Representative Custer.
Madam Chair, for Ms. McNaughton.
Ms. McNaughton.
Madam Chair, Representative Custer.
Madam Chair, Ms. McNaughton, that the point you just made really raised my eyebrows, because I've run 13 times. I've had no problem with the reporting system. And is that the reason why this last session, or this last time when we ran, we had to basically completely close out our primary stuff and then restart for the general because of this little loophole that maybe somebody had seen that I had not ever seen? Is that the reason for that? Because I thought that was the craziest thing ever, that we had to close out, I mean, all the primary stuff and then go to the general.
It's commentary.
Madam Chair, Representative Custer, actually, this law has been in rule, I think, since the 70s. So it's been there for a long time, and maybe we just missed it.
Follow-up. Madam Chair, Ms. McNaughton, but this time when there was special reporting instructions came out on how to make sure we did that, and it had never been that way before. That was correct, right? I mean, I don't ever remember getting the special instructions on just about how we had to maneuver our account between primary and general.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Custer, I might actually refer that to Commissioner Mangan because he's generally in charge of those instructions.
Okay. I'll refer then if possible.
Okay, Commissioner Mangan, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Custer, it was certainly something, again, it's back to the education that we've done over. There's a number of things that hadn't been necessarily enforced, and I shouldn't say enforced, but just ensured that we were doing correctly as we're moving forward. That, you know, my good friend Senator Cuff likes to let me know, like, the you know, anonymous contributions under $35 aren't really anonymous, and they have to maintain, you know, keep the names of those. This was another one. Particularly, we had three, it was the subject of at least three inquiries in my office, and we wanted to make sure that all candidates understood what needed to be extinguished and what they could raise moving forward, and so we had those instructions put out to all candidates. It wasn't for any specific candidate, but all local candidates, statewide candidates, state district candidates. So, yes, it's my fault.
Follow up, President.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Mangan, but I don't see why we need to go from the primary to the general, because if Representative McCain gave me $360 and I was a contested primary candidate, when I report that money from her, I would report $180 for a primary donation and $180 for a general donation, because I know I can't keep $360 from her herself in the primary because that's right. Over the limit. So why would I need to... I should already have it set up in my system that way. So I was just amazed about why I just couldn't see the need for that.
I can't remember the exact instructions that out. We wanted to ensure that people that they extinguish their primary debt before they moved their money into, and that includes loans, into the general election, because we saw, because we had so many inquiries regarding that particular issue from, in the form of complaints and then and others. So,
all right, thank you.
Okay, thank you. For the questions, Representative Binkley and then Representative Walsh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Commissioner Mangan, please.
Commissioner Mangan, please.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Thank you. I'm just going to bounce off from my neighbor here. So in the primary, I loan myself funds. I extinguish all the monies that I collected, all my donations. I still have that loan sitting out there. I do not have the funds from the primary to pay off my loan. I cannot I cannot continue that loan into the general. So okay. I loan myself money in the primary. I cannot take general funds if I don't use them all in the general and pay myself back for the funds that I loan myself in the primary. Is that what I'm understanding?
You can't. What you can do is what we're trying to avoid, and that's the question I want to have this discussion, particularly in, is you can continue to raise primary contributions in the general to alleviate that debt that you had in the loan, and that's and a lot of folks have. I don't want to say forget that, but because when the primaries open, they think it's just general, even if they had debt left over in the primary. And so what we try to do is make sure folks know that, no, just because the primary is over, if you still have debt, you certainly can raise primary contributions in the general to alleviate that primary debt. And that's what we're trying to avoid here. I don't want to say avoid. I just want to make sure it's clear that if you have money that you could have relieved that debt and you choose to move it over because it was all loans, that you just can't raise primary funds to eliminate it because you could have paid it off. That's all I don't want to go too far from the bill. So.
Well, I just want to make, pardon me.
Follow-up, Representative.
I'm sorry, pardon me. Follow-up, Madam Chair. So I don't want to lose my train of thought. I'm so sorry. So if I raise funds in the general, so let me say I depleted all my primary funds. I still had the money that I loaned myself. I start collecting funds in the general, donations. So do I have to show those as a primary donation so I can pay myself back from that primary debt? That's what I'm just looking for clarity, and that's what I'm the confusion, and it is with the bill because that's what I understood the bill was taking care of.
So. Madam Chair, yes. I guess the simple question of that is yes. And where people fall, where you have difficult with is that they forget that they can, that's because just because the primary is over doesn't mean you cannot raise primary contributions if you have that debt, and we just want to make sure people understand that they can do that and raise that extra. If you haven't raised the full 360, you certainly can. You're not, and put it towards your primary debt.
Hey,
I know what I've lost myself.
Further questions from the committee, Representative Walsh.
I'm still confused, but I think I know how to ask the question. And so I'd ask this of the bill sponsor now. Madam Chair, Senator. So what's your bill try to do now that we kind of understand a little bit of the concept? What's that going to change in what we think we understand the current situation is?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Walsh, good question. Maybe I'll try and clarify, because I think Representative Binkley is going down the right path here.
Yeah.
She's asking, I think she's right. Right now, the law would only allow you to repay that loan that you had in the primary with primary election fundraising. This bill will allow you to pay off that loan with primary and general. So you're carrying forward that loan. I mean, we all know that it's almost impossible to fundraise for primary election debt when you've gotten into the general election. So it's just, make sure that you, the candidate, aren't left with a big hole in your wallet when this is done, because this is, and I know that this is a sacrifice, and it's an expensive hobby. I shouldn't say that, but this would allow a candidate to recoup a little of what they've put into the campaign.
Follow up, Representative Walsh.
So if I ended up I put $5,000 into my primary candidate to start my election, and I raised $7,000, and then so I still had some debt left over because I spent all that $7,000 or most of it. And so I still end up, so if I get a $200 check from somebody and the campaign limit's 180, can I put the other 20 bucks extra against that loan?
No, Madam Chair, Representative Walsh, no, this does not allow you to breach the limits. The limits are the limits. So you could get a check for 180 and another check for 180, primary and general. You could use those primary and general funds to pay off your campaign debt as long as all the other debts are paid off. The loan to yourself is paid off. You have to pay off. The way this works, you cannot transfer that money until... You can't transfer the money to the general election account until all your primary election debts, except the one to yourself, are paid.
Okay.
Maybe I'll try and... You want to... Here, let me walk you through a scenario.
We need a whiteboard.
Right. All right. All right. Let's just start with $1,000.
Okay.
You put in your campaign $1,000. Let's just say in your campaign, then you receive $600 in contributions, and that's what. And then you spent.
Spent $600. Still have $1,000.
I think the better scenario is, let's just 100% self-funded campaign here. So you spend you put $1,000 into your campaign. So, and then you spent $1,000 in the primary election. You received no contributions from anybody else. So it's $1,000. You spent $1,000. The way this would work you spent $900, so you have $100 left. You've carried $100 into the general election. Now you got a $100 check in the general election. You'd be able to pay off that debt of $100 in the general election with the money. If that works. I don't know if I helped you or not.
Okay.
I think we're trying not to make this too complicated. It shouldn't be that complicated.
We may be overthinking this, but
I think we are.
I'm sorry, we've had a couple of individuals who have already had an opportunity to speak. I think we're going to move to Representative Dooling and then Representative Karjala.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Commissioner Mangan, please.
Commissioner Mangan.
Madam Chair, Representative, and there is a big smile under this mask, so just so you all know.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Madam Chair, Commissioner Mangan, so going off of Representative Binkley's, so we are better off requesting our individual donors to write us a check for more than $180 in the primary if we can convince them to do that, so that we can carry forward a balance rather than asking for $360 in the general so we can pay off our primary debt. And then you get into the reporting of the dates on the checks. Well, the date on the check is, it's July 1, but we're paying off debt from May, and the check dates don't match, and to me, it becomes really convoluted how it's set up. How do we do that?
Madam Chair, Representative Dooling, and please don't. I can't give advice to candidates as far as how to do things, and I would be the last person to do that. But all I can say is there are common questions about what happens if I get an over-the-limit contribution or someone wants to give me money in that situation, both for the general. That's why we ask candidates and instruct candidates to set up, you know, your primary account and your general election account. Keep them separate. Don't double dip. Don't, you know, double dip's the wrong word. Don't intermix. So it can be completely separate by the time that happens, so you can make those decisions moving forward. I know it's complicated. I know it's difficult. I wish I could give advice. I can't. Just like I wish I could write everybody a check. I can't. I'm lucky. I'm one of the, I'm probably the only person in Montana that's statutorily prohibited from giving a campaign contribution. And it's days like this, I'm glad. So at least I don't have to keep that paperwork. I don't mean to make light of it, but it is serious, and I understand what you guys go through. And I understand what the senator's trying to do here. Our disconcern, again, is just that the amount of the debt can't be more than what a primary contribution could have been raised for. And that, as long as you have that discussion about intent, I think you might be able to get through this in executive action, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Representative Cargiola.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Mangan, please.
Commissioner Mangan.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioner Mangan. So if I were in the primary and I loaned myself $3,000, I spent $4,000. Overall, I have a total of $1,000 outstanding debt heading into the general. But I raised, I guess take that back. So just leave it at, I have a loan of $3,000. I spent $4,000, but I raised $9,000. So moving forward into the general, if I chose to only use my primary contributions to pay off the $4,000 that I spent, does this bill allow me to carry that $3,000 loan forward to continue to raising primary donations to pay off that $3,000?
Madam Chair, Representative Cargiola, I believe I followed your math. It would, and our concern is that you could have paid, because you would have $5,000 left, you could have paid that $3,000 debt to yourself, still at $2,000 to forward to the general election, then you wouldn't have any primary debt, and you could just raise general election funds. That's what we're trying, that's what I've been apparently horribly trying to say, that's the kind of how the process is meant to work. What I'm concerned about is then that whole $5,000 gets paid off, you still have $3,000 of debt on the books, and that not anybody in this room would do, or the good senator, but could raise primary election funds in excess of that $3,000 that you'd have that could be used in the general, thus potentially skirting Montana's campaign finance laws. Okay, I think maybe that last one helped.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions from the committee? Representative Custer.
Madam Chair, for Commissioner Mangan.
Commissioner Mangan.
Madam Chair, Representative Custer.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Mangan, Ms. McNaughton mentioned that at the close of the primary, if you had $5,000 in funds and you had a $5,000 in debt, and if you just moved them, that would allow that $5,000 in debt to be, they could keep raising. But why couldn't, by rule, say, if you want to do that, that's fine, but your debt's basically extinguished. You know, so if you wanted to move your debt so that you weren't depleting your cash that you needed right away, that your primary debt's extinguished as a primary, you can't do that. Or whatever debt you're going to move, if whatever money, whatever cash you've got minus your debt is all that you can really move forward, and that you're not going to collect any more primary funds on that. Unless you really do have primary debt,
right. Madam
moving
Chair,
forward. If the difference between your expenditures and your revenues are your cash on hand and what your debt is, that's all that you can. If you have a deficit, you can raise primary monies on it. If not, it's a done deal. You just got to consider it a primary. By rule, if we pass this bill, because that's the intent of this bill, I think, so we don't have to do this.
I understand. Madam Chair, Representative Custer, absolutely, that's something we could do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee? Senator, would you like to close on your bill?
Thank you, committee. Thank you for the good hearing. I shouldn't try, but I will. I think of it this very simply: is you have the debt, you've spent money on your campaign, and this will allow you to recover your debt with primary and general election contributions. We're not blowing limits out of the place. This is money you've already spent. You're just getting reimbursed for what you've put into the campaign with general or primary, and because as Representative Dueling pointed out, tracking which check is a primary one or a general one, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's just too hard. Let's make it easy for everybody. This is what people do anyway. So it's life has not ended with this practice that most people are doing anyway, or by many people, I won't say that, but life goes on. So the simple bill, I think it will hopefully clear up things and allow people to be reimbursed for a little of what they put into their campaign. So thank you, Madam Chair, for your time today. I've enjoyed coming here to State Administration. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. We've enjoyed having you here, and this closes the hearing on Senate Bill 226. Thank you, one and all. We will not be doing executive action today. We cannot. It's just not possible to adequately give it the attention that we need, which brings me to we probably don't want to meet on Monday. I can, right? Right, okay. We're going to have a short meeting on Monday. We're going to have a short meeting on Monday, just because we have to be here for 1 o'clock anyway. We're going to meet at 10. We're going to do some executive action, and I don't know if we'll be hearing bills or not. I have yet to decide that. I have not scheduled bills until Tuesday, but we will do some executive action on Monday because we have been instructed to try in our presiding officer training to try to get through all of our scheduled bills through this next week and have it done by Friday. I really think we need to be doing that. 10 o'clock on Monday is what we'll be doing. So sorry. But anyway, there we are. Okay. Representative Heyman.
Madam Chair, could we know the bills we'll hear in EA on Monday?
Yes. I will post that later. You'll have the HR 3 and SB 120. And we might do a couple of these Fitzpatrick bills. SB 113 for sure. Beyond that. Oh, 196, excuse me, yeah. I said 120. It's 196. I keep trying to redo 120. We've already done 120. Excuse me. 196.
SB?
SB 196. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, there is one thing that we need to do. Yes, thank you very much, Vice Chair Grief. In order to lighten the load in our packets, if you would quickly take this remaining time and clean out all but these numbers from your packets. Okay, this is not going to include the work that we did today, please. Nor the work that we did yesterday. I guess I can. Okay, so leave only 563. That's House Bill 563, House Bill 421, Senate Bill 169, House Bill 59, House Bill 613. All of the bills that we heard today and then yesterday would have been House Bill 3 and House Bill 196. Is that right?
I'm lost.
Okay. Okay, I'll write. Do you want me to write them on the board?
Yeah.
Okay.
So these are the ones that will stay.
That will stay in the packet. The ones that will stay in the packet. Okay, all of these plus It is, and you're taking it off for sure, right?
It's been killed.
Okay.
So it's out.
Okay. I just don't have paperwork on it. And
I know. I just did that today.
Okay.
Wow.
All right.
They could do that. Even for a day. I thought I was going to have to do
that.
I'm not sure where it is. We'll have that discussion.
Okay, in addition to the bills that we heard today, those who are in Zoom land, we will have, let's see, I'm leaving one off. Hold on. These are the only ones that we'll be keeping in our packet. We put them out here and they go away. Let's see, Mr. Berglofen, will you take a minute and make a packet for Mr. Fitzpatrick? Okay, is it, that's all of them
that
right
is,
there?
That is all of them.
Okay, then these are the extras. They can go here.
I have.
Okay. Unless you think you need to take,
I have a copy.
If you have a copy, and you can, so you can post them for the Zoom land. Okay. Zoom land. Do you need to have the ones that we didn't do yesterday and today? House Bill 421, House Bill 59, House Bill 613, and Senate Bill 619. That is, that's Cuffs. That's Cuffs Bill. It's a voter ID.
Which one is that?
169 is voter ID.
Okay.
Yes, Representative Heyman, by all means, did I answer your question? Did you have something else to add? Okay.
And we also did not gavel out.
We're not gaveling out yet.
Yep, not yet. For my record.
Ooh, much longer. Yeah, isn't that nice?
We haven't gaveled out.
Yeah.
Well.
That's what I had trouble managing at home. All the paperwork.
Okay. So are there any questions about what we have left in our folders? Are there any questions about when we'll meet? 10 o'clock on Monday. And I will get the information to you about the executive action and if we will have a bill hearing for Monday. Okay? All right.
How long did it take to get from Missoula here?
3 hours.
Two hours.
An hour and a half. Oh, okay. All right. Well, okay. I'm not sure what that was. I see. I see. Okay. Well, you've got to be back for 1 o'clock anyway, so. Okay. If there is no further business to come before this committee at this time, House State Administration will be adjourned this 12th day of March 2021.
Half the committee's
I know. They had another something.